Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right, it's about a minute past the hour. We begin this midweek edition of this truncated holiday week on the horn. It is the 27th day of November, 2013. I tweeted earlier that Dr. Bill was feeling kind of under the weather, so we simply reran another program of his. He'll be back this coming Monday with his usual wit and wisdom. And, of course, my best wishes to Dr. Bill to get feeling better in a real hurry. It kind of sucks feeling bad the day before Thanksgiving when you're supposed to, you know, gorge yourself. I hope you get to feeling better quickly, Dr. Bill. All of us in the Horn family do. And program note update. I double-checked with the boss, otherwise known as Agnes. And I see no reason why there will not be a program on Friday evening. So the week is not going to be as truncated as we thought it was. I might or might not. Who knows? It depends on my mood, frankly. Take tomorrow night off for Thanksgiving. But I may be here. I may be here. Maybe just in solidarity with all the people in this country who are being forced to work on this on the day tomorrow. And, of course, there are a couple of heroic stories in the stack this evening that you may or may not have heard about yet of people who are pushing back against what do you call it? Just the recognition that profits are more important than families, that the corporate profit and the corporate bottom line is far more important than. And I took some, well, not flack, but, you know, people were saying, you know, hey, Bob, people need to work. Maybe, you know, there are people who live alone. Who'd be happy to work tomorrow? Yeah, I guess so. But my impressions are colored by the way I grew up. And I've mentioned before that my father, even when he was when he became a foreman, part of middle management, I guess, of the company that operated that furnace where he worked. Even after he worked rotating shifts, which is a brutalism. 1 week he would work 4 to 12, 4 p.m. to midnight. The next week he would work midnight to 8. The next week he would work 8 to 4 or the day shift. The 4 to 12, the midnight shift, and the day shift. That was the measure of my father's working world. And you don't shut a furnace down for Christmas or Thanksgiving or your kid's birthday. You just deal with it because that's the nature of work. So I got to thinking, and I can't remember how many Thanksgivings we actually had my father at the table, and ours was a so-called traditional family. My mother stayed at home, my father worked. That was back in the America where it was possible for one person to work and the other to stay at home and to manage to run a household on a single income. Gone are the days, as it were. But I can't remember. I mean, they were so damned few that I can't remember if it, through my childhood, if it was two or three Christmases or two or three Thanksgivings that we actually had my father in the house for the holiday, because again, they don't shut down furnaces for holidays. These are processes that are ongoing, I guess, is to say the very least. But that's a far cry from Wally World. And I feel really badly because I've got, Agnes and I have three precious, beautiful little grandchildren who will not see their father for some significant portion of tomorrow. Maybe they will on Christmas. Who knows? I haven't heard if we've gotten around to that outrage yet. See, you can be a non-believer in great big bearded juvenile delinquents in the sky and still think that having time off where we all sort of ritually pay lip service to the idea that families actually matter matters. But I kind of grieve. No, I don't kind of. I do. I'm sad. Because it's a tough thing to introduce a five-year-old to the reality of daddy isn't here because... How do you explain capitalist, free market, predatory economics to a five-year-old? Right. So that's where I... So, I don't know. Maybe I'll be on the air tomorrow evening. Maybe. Listen, before we jump out too far into the process, I did run the numbers shortly before airtime. And it was, as I said, we are deeply in a hole this November. And I don't think we can lay it all off on Thanksgiving. I don't even think we can say that it had something to do with me being gone for a couple of days. I mean, three days out of the... No. But we are. We're right at between $700 and $1,000 in the hole for finishing the month of November. And those kinds of deficits are dire. Those kinds of deficits make it possible to say, hey, gee, I don't know. Maybe we'll be here January. Maybe the heck we won't. But so I am especially thankful for the note that I got from Dr. John earlier this evening. He said, hey, Bob, it's time for a $50 contribution challenge. I'll match the first $50 to come in tonight in any combination. What we've built here, this community, is so valuable to me, and I only wish I could support it in a way that matched that value. And I say, of course, that an expression like that is a metric of the value far more than, frankly, money is, except for the fact that money is what pays the bills. So thank you very much, Dr. John. Dr. John will match the first 50 bucks that come in any combination. And, you know, maybe we'll go from there. Maybe this evening, maybe Friday, we can take, maybe tomorrow evening, we can take steps toward finishing this November better than it looks like it's going to finish now. So thank you very much, Dr. John. The first $50 that comes in, he will match. Thank you. Thank you again. And, of course, this is prayer meeting Wednesday. I'm gonna keep the nasty old preacher man. Well, we'll give him Thanksgiving off. What do you say? It is not, by the way, raining anymore. Overnight, it turned to snow here, and we awoke this morning to about 4 to 6 inches of snow on the ground. And even for flinty old cynic like me, the first view of untrodden, untreaded, undriven over, unslushed, unmushed, unyucked snow, well, hell, it's just beautiful. It is absolutely gorgeous. Getting out and driving on it's a real adventure, but that's why maybe you stay home. But we got a big snow last night. And the skies remain gray, and the snow continues to fall. And for now, it's beautiful. It is, as we say around these parts, colder than a well digger's ass back here in the studio. But that's not because anything's broken down. No, that's just because the walls are unfinished, and there's a thin layer of insulation between the outside world and in here. We've got a heater going for what it's worth. And I found out something marvelous about that classic piece of upper Midwestern headgear, the Stormy Cromer, which Bruce, our buddy Bruce in Wisconsin, introduced me to. I have the genuinely I hate cold version because my Stormy Cromer actually has a layer of thinsulate in it. I don't think your head could get cold at the South freaking pole with this thing on. And one of the beautiful things is you can wear it in your not very warm broadcast studio. What is it in here? Yeah, 60 degrees. It's been worse. But you can wear it in your not very warm broadcast studio. And because of the miracle of in-ear monitors, you don't have a big bulky headphone headset getting in the way. So I'm warm as toast. I've got my outside let's go shushing down the slopes red coat on with lots of insulation. It crinkles rather a bit. You might be able to hear that from time to time. That's what that is. And I think it's going to be a very, very pleasant 3 hours back here, I hope. And maybe as, depending on time permitting, a recitation of that classic Kincaid family night before Thanksgiving grocery shopping story. I haven't told that in a while. Somehow or another, I managed to blow past it. But now that the kids are older, maybe it merits a retelling. That's the funny thing about family legends. They grow and change over the years such that what began as a horrifying event, particularly in the life of the lovely Agnes, has transmogrified over time from horrifying to slightly to don't you dare grin, Bob, I swear to God I'll divorce you, to we both chuckle about it now and then, to outright guffawing, to now with the children almost grown, we look back on it with the little miracle that takes place with the passage of time, where things take on a sort of warmed tone of being lit by the slanting half light of the past fading into the distance, to the point that it's like, oh yeah, our precious children really were like that, weren't they? Wait, were we saying we were laughing? No, my God. So maybe some time for that. And it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday, and we've got a full slate, and we've got other stuff as well. But I did see, and it's rather unusual, but I did see that the phone had lit up here as we began the program. And this being the night before Thanksgiving, and this being Prayer Meeting Wednesday and whatnot, let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Paul from Parts Unknown.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing good. I got on the phone line a little earlier than I anticipated. I'm on the road traveling in Northern California trying to visit friends and get home to my folks for the holiday tomorrow.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. So how far are you from home?
I'm approaching Weed, California now, and probably another 5 hours on the road past then.
Well, do by all means stay safe. Of course, you've got a little bit more daylight remaining to you being on the West Coast, but does it look like there's a lot of holiday travelers out there?
No, not yet. Everything is good. I wanted to wish you and your family and the whore commune a happy Thanksgiving, and I also wanted to raise Dr. John's $50 challenge, another $50. So, Dr. John, if you cover the first $50 that comes in, I'll cover the next.
Wow. Thank you, Paul. Thank you very, very much. I can't tell you how badly that's needed. Well, I think I did earlier, but you get a sense of it.
Yeah. No, I wanted to give a call and let that go on. Hold on one second. Sorry, I had to sneeze. Still getting over a cold.
I was going to say, you sound a little upper respiratory-ish.
Yeah, it's that time of year. I'm glad I could finally call in. Out here on the West Coast, I'm working when I'm not having a day off during the Kincaid show.
Well, and I was going to ask you, without too much detail, without detail or anything, how has that been going?
It's been going real well. I've been working real hard, and it's paying off, and I'm paying off debts and bills and such.
Beautiful. And is it work that you're, because I know you went through a world of study to get where you are. Is it satisfying within the realm of what you would hope to be doing?
Very much so. I'm still in the learning phase. so training and whatnot, and after 2 years of being a manufacturing scientist or so, I'll really know my stuff enough to really have the fun, really get into the fun stuff.
That's awesome.
It's been a really, really good year. I've also been spending what spare time I can working on the Palmans.
I admit I have nothing but my own self interest at heart here. I was going to ask you what's going on the Palman front.
I'm making them. I have a Palman challenge for December in the works, and I will email you details about that later and think if it, and see if you think it's a good idea.
Okay, because I gotta tell you, I think there's a business future in this for those things, frankly. But it's amazing. Everybody who has ever had them has contacted me and said, he's not kidding. They really are that good.
Yeah, but I'd have to hire a lot of people because the carpal tunnel would just kill your hands peeling the skins off the nuts when you blanch the water. Let's move into the food porn portion of the program. When you blanch the almonds in boiling water for about a minute and take them out and let them cool for about five, they're still wet and hot, and you just sort of pop them out like a grape. And, you know, you do that thousands of times repeatedly. It kills your hands after a while, after a couple of hours or so.
Yeah, that is kind of brutal, without a doubt. I've been through the process, not of that, but I've skinned many a poblano pepper and a whole bunch of tomatoes for canning over the years, and in addition to the carpal tunnel, when you're dealing with the peppers and the tomatoes, the acids and the capsaicins can be a real joy too.
Ooh, add that as getting underneath your fingernails and such. Ooh, that's a real labor of love, Bob.
There are extracurricular or extraneous things that can happen along the way that seem to occur even if you are wearing rubber gloves or anything that make it extra fun. Things that you pass down as family wisdom, as in, nobody do this after you've been doing that. I swear, I promise you don't want to.
Yeah.
And you can probably well imagine.
Yeah, anyways, I wanted to ask if anyone, I've been out of the loop for a couple of days, has anyone talked about the Supreme Court case that's coming to fruition about the birth control pill for the Affordable Care Act? The birth control, if the employer doesn't believe in it, they don't want to pay for it.
I babbled on about it a little bit the other night, and some others have as well. But by all means, share your impression.
My typical, I have really kind of two thoughts about it. Really, one is that any religion, you could shut down healthcare with any religion. If I don't believe in medical science at all, I could really cut off healthcare for my employees quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this raises the question, if Hobby Lobby gets away with this because they don't want to provide, and have you noticed, Paul, there is a new trope going around the commentary world. Birth control pills are no longer being referred to as birth control pills. They have been short formed to slut pills, because that's apparently what the right wing thinks they are. If you go back to back when the oxymoron Flush Flimball was attacking Sandra Fluck, he suggested that if she did in fact get contraception, that she should then videotape all of her sexual encounters for the world to watch. Nice guy, that Flimball.
Yeah.
But yeah, you raise an important question, because let's say Hobby Lobby gets away with this. Well, aren't the next people in line going to be the Christian Scientists who don't want to pay for any medical procedures whatsoever? And how about the Jehovah's Witnesses, who believe that that their special friend in the sky will send the creatures that he has created and loves straight to hell if they get a blood transfusion, so they don't want to pay for blood transfusions? Did these asshats, well, at least six of them on the Supreme Court, understand what a Pandora's box they're opening?
They may do, but my second thought is I'm not too worried about the case, because at some point the pharmaceutical companies are going to you know, make their voice heard, saying, "Hey, we make a lot of money selling these birth control pills." And typically, even in conservative land, when it is money versus when it's business versus religion, business typically wins.
You know, I used to hold pretty fast to that concept too, Paul. Except for one thing that I've noticed, I would have thought that during the great food stamp debate, that somebody in Bentonville would have picked up the phone and called John Boehner and said, "Listen, this is a huge chunk of Walmart's grocery sales, these SNAP benefits, and you want to cut $25 billion out of it?"
Yeah, that you make an excellent point.
But either that call didn't get made, or the teabaggers just don't care. They're the bull in the china shop. They're the raging horde that's blown through the city gates, and they're just going to destroy whatever they can lay hands on. And what they seem to be laying hands on is what used to pass for our republic.
Well, that's an excellent point and also very unsettling.
Unfortunately, it is. Welcome to my mind. This is the stuff that puts the straw in the tequila bottle, Paul.
Yeah, and I wasn't really there with you, and then I started listening to Dr. Bill's show about a month ago, and him talking about the run-up to the Civil War and the Confederation period and how educational it is, but also it gives a lot more weight to the teabaggers in terms of, you know, how freaked out I am, because in a sense, he argues we've been here before, and it's not a good place to be.
No, and the problem is digging out from it is a real mess. And I don't, since it was about a month ago you mentioned, I don't know if you caught it. Dr. Bill was out yesterday. I think he's not just feeling that real good. He was out yesterday and today, so no live programs. But on Monday, he made reference to an article that I immediately went and read, and I think a lot of other members of the Horn Family Commune have gone and read, Paul, and I commend it to you as well. It's available from the Harper's Magazine archive, and it's called "The Paranoid Style in American Politics." It was first published as an essay by Richard Hofstadter in November of 1964, a year after the assassination of JFK, and just weeks after the defeat of Barry Goldwater. And it was it is absolutely stunning to read. It's not a long read. But what he's describing in November of 1964 could just as well have the dateline of November 2013 on it, because as Dr. Bill observed on Monday, it is chapter and verse a description of people like Glenn Beck, Alex Jones, and the entire right-wing hate media.
Well, I will read that article. I find Dr. Bill's program is incredibly informative, and he has an excellent way of, he is educated, knowledgeable about various periods of American history, and he makes some interesting enlightening, and then he can tie it to the present day like that, as you call dropping the axe or dropping the hammer.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Yeah. How that happens, I don't know.
Oh,
I don't
yeah.
know anybody who else who does that, Paul, or does it the way he does. It seems like everybody else just puts everything out front, but Dr. Bill is an academic, and he doesn't want people simply to regurgitate ideas back at them. He wants to craft a cogent and compelling argument in favor of his position, or in some cases just pin or orate a crushing brief against another position, and have people see his line of thinking, so that then they and it really is. It's like it's you know it's an axe handle in the head.
Yeah. While I was driving through California. I was listening to the radio. I have a, you know, mid-90s car, and so, you know, no MP3 player auxiliary jack, so I have to, you know, do it old school and listen to the actual, you know, FM radio for good music, and I'm waiting for the Bob Kincaid show to come on. I wanted to ask you as a radio guy something I noticed, since I'm in an unfamiliar area and I'm just hitting the scan button and scanning until I find kind of some good stations. There's even in Northern California and Mid-California, there's a lot of Christian rock stations and Christian talk stations. And I was wondering, as a radio guy, if you could answer this question sometimes during the scan, it would there would be like two separate stations of Christian talk playing the same person, like it's the exact same thing, you know. In one case, they were like on opposite ends of the dial, so as my scan cycled through, it's like, in a sense, one station away, even though it's on the other side of the dial, and it picks right up where the person left off at the same person speaking. Why, business-wise, from a radio perspective, are you broadcasting the exact same thing on two different stations?
It may or may not be necessarily that case. First of all, let's understand that especially if you're down there in the low 90s on the FM band, I assume we're talking FM.
FM, correct.
Okay. If you're down there in the low 90s, those frequencies were set aside by the FCC for non-commercial programming. I mean, that's generally where your public radio lives, where your community FMs live. And the FCC conceived of that portion of the bandwidth as truly a manifestation of the use of the public airwaves by something resembling the public. Well, the other side are so far out in front of progressives and liberals in terms of media savvy, and again, this goes back to 1964, it goes to the 1972 Powell memo, it goes to Richard Viguerie and direct mail. These are all deliberate attempts. So the religion industry went out. They stood not upon the order of their going, but they went at once and bought up these little chunks of bandwidth, these openings, these frequencies. And what was supposed to be local programming turns out to instead be satellite feeds down to individual frequencies and or translators. So that the public airwaves become monopolized by the religion industry. That's one thing. The other thing is that one frequency may let's look at the other alternative, where one company owns two different frequencies. Well, they will simulcast the same programming on different frequencies based upon the coverage pattern that they have for one frequency versus another. And so you may drive through the sort of Venn diagram overlap between those two frequencies, or you may drive out of one and into another.
Gotcha, that makes sense.
But it's all very savvy, and it's all very sophisticated, and it is designed as much to keep anything resembling progressive or liberal or enlightened broadcasting off the public airwaves as it is to make sure that they've got their god-awful, constitutionally protected hustle going 24/7.
And
there's an entire network of programming availability. I mean, I remember driving away from Washington, D.C. out on I-66,
Hello?
And yeah, I'm here. Out on I-66, and catching a broadcast coming out of some bizarre end times Bible study church school thingamajig in Oklahoma, and it was
outside Washington D.C.
Yeah, and that was because that programming had been picked up by some local station owner. It's not like it's some sort of shortwave broadcast.
Right.
But this stuff is promulgated all over the United States. And, of course, these religious broadcasters are hungry for content, or in some cases, depending on how wealthy they are, they will even pay to have their program aired.
That's pretty good dodge/hustle. I don't even know if that's free market if you're just losing money to basically dominate the area.
Well, and the thing is, they could never do it on a for-profit basis, Paul. Remember, not a penny of this is taxed.
Ah.
It's like the preacher with the lovely Australian accent says in the prayer meeting Wednesday song, and it's all tax-free. You know, you could never run a business on this model. But you can darn sure run a so-called tax-free hustle on it all day long. Because it doesn't matter. They're because they're selling tickets into heaven and out of hell, and all they got to do is make people who are looking at the end of their lives think that, you know, maybe God's going to like them a little bit better if they support that broadcast outfit, you know, because you know, Christianity and saving souls.
Well, thanks for answering that question.
Well, I hope it was an answer.
I don't listen to the radio hardly at all, so except on rare occasions like this, and when I'm in the car, and I was just shocked, you know, picking up, I'll make up a number, probably about 15 to 20 stations on a whole scan through of the FM frequency, about how, you know, five or six of them were, you know, Christian rock / Christian talk. And it's just like, that's disturbing.
Well, and isn't it disturbing that there is even Christian talk now? And Lord, there is.
Oh yeah.
Wait, you know, now I had, let me just advise you, if you ever run across this, I want you to pull off to the side of the road until you've heard enough of it so that you won't run off the side of the road. Wait till you pick up a broadcast of Brian Fisher or any of the other weirdos from the American Family Association. I mean,
no, hearing the clips from your show are enough. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they're out there every day. I will never forget. We were driving home from Netroots Nation out in Minneapolis a few summers back, and we were driving through Talibandiana.
Yeah.
And I was hitting the scan button just like you are.
Yeah.
And down on the low 90s end of the FM dial, I suddenly picked up some right wing. Phony baloney Christianity hustle show where an over-the-road truck driver was calling in to some nebulous host asking if Jesus would ever forgive him because the trucks he drove carried condoms that were keeping little baby Christians from being born to have their souls won for Jesus. And that's why I suggested, Paul, that you, if you ever run across this, you pull gently off the road, because I about ran off it. I mean, straight into the ditch.
Yeah, I think, especially after coming home from Netroots Nation, Bob, that might be known as what we could coin a progressive buzzkill.
Oh no, that was a buzz slaughter. That was a buzz murder. That was a buzz massacre. I mean, that was a take the buzz out behind the woodshed and, you know, two go in and one comes out.
Hmm. Really. So, yeah, I haven't contacted the show in a while, but having listened to the news, having a lot of thoughts. And the most predominant one I have is when Dr. Bill's talking about how when there's an issue that has faced the American government that is unable to compromise, and they'll just kick it down the road until they can't kick it down the road anymore, and then it just blows up, i.e. see Civil War, with the issue of slavery being kicked down from the creation of the Constitution in the 1780s to the 1850s when it started getting out of hand. And I can't help but think, tying this to the science world, that another uncompromising issue is what to do about climate change. You can't go halfway. You can't have the solar power plant sitting next to the coal plant and have them both working at the same time.
You know what? That's you're early in the running, Paul, for this evening's toaster. That's beautiful. Because you just created this mental image for me of a bunch of solar collectors with this grimy film of coal dust filth laying across it.
Yeah, that's a good visual. Shocked, dismayed is a good word. I was dismayed at the lack of progress made at the climate summit in Poland a couple weeks back after the tropical storm, if that's what you want to call it, hit the Philippines.
Were you? Wait, time out. Were you really shocked?
Well, no. What happened in Poland is what I would expect to happen at a climate summit before the storm, but with the storm preceding it, I thought it would actually be big enough because it was a Category 5 tropical storm, simply because there is no Category 6. you know, just like there's no 11 on the volume dial.
Right.
You know, it was way, you know, way, way huge, historical, oh my goodness.
Yeah, the needle was pegged, and there was no way of knowing what the real force was, and yeah.
And the Philippines representative gave an impassioned speech. He went on a hunger strike. And I thought that, you know, maybe it was an obvious enough and dramatic enough event to maybe loosen up the system a little bit to recognize this. But it was a continuation of the kicking the can down the road with this climate change thing, because it's an uncompromising situation, and it will just... So it will blow. I think that might just blow us up in terms of like government.
Well, and that was my next question, Paul, because you have a considerable amount of science background, if I recall correctly, and
yeah.
you mentioned that phrase kicking the can down the road. At this point in time, doesn't it begin to look like the can is going to outlast the road?
Oh yeah. Well. You'll kick it off a cliff, or you'll kick it into a dead end.
That's what I mean.
You'll kick it and it bounce off the dead end wall back to your foot because you'll have nowhere else to go. Once these storms start becoming common enough or big enough that it starts disrupting commerce, I'd probably say the first thing will happen are like large freighters, super tankers. They can endure quite a storm, but I don't think they can endure something, you know, the Philippines storm size. And when they start really having to lay commerce to avoid these storms and reroute shipping to such an effect it damages profits hugely, maybe, possibly, they'll think about addressing it. But I just see it. It's got a... There's no compromise, there's no half measures that anyone's willing to take. I'd say, save for Jimmy Carter, which was probably the era where you could start talking about half measures and small steps. But it's just going to be no movement until there's no choice, and you're just going to have to take giant, big leaps. I'd say if we started now, we'd have to take moderate to big steps to actually try to put the genie back in the bottle the best we can.
And I know there's a significant element of people out there who think that somehow or another... some development in the scientific world will solve our problems. That's going to be, you know, there's going to be there's going to be a magic bullet, or something is going to happen that's going to create a complete paradigm change, and everything's going to be okay. We'll learn to engineer the atmosphere, for instance. I've read about that stuff.
Even if you could do that, it's about energy. Where are you going to get the energy to engineer the atmosphere? It's, you know, it's an energy problem. It's, the atmosphere is massively huge. And if you're getting that energy from non-green sources, then, you know, you're lucky if you get a net no change in that one, A. And B, you know, that's a fair... Science saving us is a fair... belief, because most people that don't know scientific history, science has saved us before. In the early 1900s, the invention of the chemical reaction to use a catalyst to draw nitrogen out of the air and make it ammonium nitrate to put it in fertilizer and replenish some of the nutrients in soil so that you could make more bountiful farming so that there was food enough to feed the population and allow their population worldwide to grow even more because we could get more food out of the land. And the polio vaccine, the solution of the 70s with the dwarf wheat, the wheat in India was too tall, bending over and crushing it, breeding it down so it was actually the stalks were shorter so they could grow it in that environment and stop famine in India. So maybe science hasn't saved the world, but it saved major swaths of countries a few times over in the past couple hundred years, but this might be too big a problem to solve. It would take beyond science. It would take massive industry, government.
It would take something beyond even the idea of a Marshall Plan.
Yeah, it would take to solve global climate change. If we're going to wait until, like, you know, the night before the papers due, in homework sense, or the week before the your final papers due, and you've had a year to work on it, it would take a massive community social effort with every government, every type of person, from farmer to scientist to news reporter to politician, committed to solving the problem before we as a species go back down to the original 2,000 humans that we're all related to universally to begin with way back, 200,000 years ago.
I think it's clear that we have massive problems ahead of us. And the thing is, you, me, the Horn family, a whole lot of people understand the gravity of climate change. But what we're finding out is that some of the basic premises of democracy don't hold true, largely because this is not a democracy, but also, rules, the things about, you don't need a majority, you only need a plurality, or not even a plurality, but a part of a plurality, because this country is being held hostage by a bunch of nabobs who think the earth is slightly younger than the written recipe for beer, and who think that Satan planted dinosaur bones in the rocks to confuse the unbelievers.
Yeah,
and it is just enough to screw us all.
In my more naive years, when I was younger, I tried in having conversations with people about climate change and whatnot, and this was, 10, 15 years ago, I say, okay, where's your line? You don't think I'm right. You don't think the science is in. I think that you're wrong. I think that you're living in denial land, that things are changing, and that, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is like, windows of your car. Sun shines on the windows of your car. Your car gets a lot hotter inside the car than outside the car because the windows are there transforming the light energy into heat. Same idea. I can't convince them that. Where's your line? Where do we draw the line that, okay, once weather starts happening and these things that you're predicting start happening and the polar ice caps start melting, when do you go, okay, I was wrong? And they do draw some of the lines, but I've had conversations with people where they just, and I see it now happening in a meme on the conservative side, where, okay, these storms are God's wrath. God was angry at the Philippines, and God was angry at New Orleans for Katrina for some reason. Or they didn't pray hard enough. And I have literally just gotten to a point where, time to shut the bus doors and drive on off. We've been idling too long, as you have said.
The problem is, though, meanwhile, those people who think that God's angry at the Philippines are back there just out of sight of the big rearview mirrors sugaring the gas tank of the bus.
Yeah, but before we depress the horde audience too much, the one thing that does give me hope is Mahatma Gandhi, who said, first they laugh at you, first then they fight you, and then they, was it agree with you? What's the third thing?
First they fight you, then they laugh at you, then you win.
Oh, you win. Oh, they fight you first?
Yeah.
I thought they laugh at you first. Oh, well.
Maybe you've got it right.
Because in the 90s and into the 2000s, they were laughing at people that were proponents of climate change. Al Gore was a joke. And maybe he still is to some people, but mostly they tend to be trying to fight Al Gore's work with the Inconvenient Truth and whatnot. And fighting, I can't remember his name, the founder and the head of the 350.org?
Shame on me.
Yeah.
And James Hansen, too.
Yeah. By the way, Mr. Stress, you don't have to be old to not remember names of important people. I'm in my mid-30s, and I'm having the same problem.
Well, I just took a powder on somebody that I know. And
yeah.
No, not at all. Yeah, Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben. See, that's what chat rooms are for. Thank you, Lottie. Bill McKibben.
Yeah, but they're not laughing at those people or dismissing those people anymore. They're trying to fight them with really bad science that really isn't science or peer review. They're just trying to get a voice out to try to counter it. So they are fighting us. So, I'd like to think we're moving into stage two, and then we're just going to win. And we're going to win because we can't afford to lose, and if we do lose on this issue, on mountaintop removal, the whole environment, if we do lose, then everybody loses. It's literally a scorched earth policy, and that's never truer when talking about mountaintop removal or the sandblasting of the Pinokies, because that is just scorched earth.
And you know, the funny thing for me, Paul, is this. On the one hand, are you familiar in the religious studies realm of the thing called Pascal's Wager?
No, I'm thinking of Occam's Razor, which is different.
Okay, hopefully I'll get this right. This is really, really thumbnail-y. But Pascal's Wager says, okay, so you don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and you don't believe that magic crackers turn into Jesus meat, and magic wine turns into Jesus blood. You don't believe any of that. Still, isn't it worth being a Christian to get that ticket into heaven just in case they're right?
False logic.
Absolutely. But the point that I'm moving toward, Paul, is that you'll get that from this crowd day in and day out. These believers, these millennialists, because Jesus is going to come back, and it's all, you know, we're all going to have frisbees and wheat checks right after they get done forcing the Jews to confess Christ and slaughter the ones who don't. That furious little blood frenzy that they're all looking forward to.
But my response to that would be, well, that only works if those are the two options. What if Hinduism is actually real? Shiva is actually real, and Kali is actually real, and their rules actually apply, and you'll be going to hell for believing in Jesus. And Kali is, I don't know, it's sort of a competition whether Kali or the devil is a bit more brutal in the afterlife. But I'm not an expert on it.
Yeah, right. What if the Egyptian Book of the Dead is actually right? But the larger point that I'm reaching toward here, Paul, is that these people will hustle Pascal's Wager day in and day out, and yet if you look at them and say, okay, let's say we are completely wrong about global climate change, wouldn't it be nice to have your own solar energy and not have a power bill anymore?
Or wouldn't it be nice to have a bit cleaner environment?
Wouldn't it be nice not to be breathing ultrafine particulate matter and getting to go to the doctor and get that grim look that, well, you got cancer?
Well, Bob, those ultrafine particulate matters put hair on your chest. It's good for you.
Ultrafine hairs, apparently.
Oh, yes.
But you see my point, right?
Oh, yeah.
They can, in a word, swallow a mountain and gag on a gnat.
I haven't heard of that one. I've not heard that saying. That's hilarious. Got me as good as one time you said, don't have enough sense to pour piss out of a boot with the instructions on the heel.
That's them, too.
So, yeah. But, yeah, just wanting to end this part of the conversation on hope in terms of just, I think we're further down the road on climate change because we're getting more resistance. And it's just going to take patience and time. I have, for lack of a better word, faith that it will come around. People are talking. It's becoming more self-evident. And it's becoming, people are dismissing the denial a bit more now.
I need badly to hear things like that from time to time from people like you. And Paul, it's a reminder that it's not just my voice going out. It's your voice coming back and then going out. Because just based on the life I live and the world I live in and the work we do, it's real easy to look at all of this stuff and throw one's hands into the air and say, right?
Oh, yeah.
But there are lots of people doing the right things all over the world. I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, some young, at least one young West Virginian that I know of, got his skull cracked for protesting at UBS, urging them to quit funding mountaintop removal. He's got a chipped tooth. Some violence was done. But
yeah.
People are willing to put their existences on the line, their own personal well-being.
Oh yeah, and if it makes the Horn family feel any better, I'm borderline Generation X, Generation Y, but I kind of relate more to the millennial generation. we're starting to, you know, get married and have kids. And no matter what you believe about climate change or the knowledge or whatever, when you're looking into a baby's eyes, a toddler's eyes, that's yours, the truth crystallizes in an instant. And maybe you've seen it in your children who have children of their own, your older ones. The truth crystallizes in an instant. If we do not make a future for these children, they will have no future.
And they will spit on the ground at the mention of our names.
Well, and nothing is more ferocious than the mama bear and the papa bear defending their cubs, and that's how they see it. I think in the next few years, you're going to see even more fierce fighters fighting for their children, because we're old enough. I've seen the climate shift just walking around in the past 30 years I've been on this planet. And to know it's going to shift even more when my children are my age, see that even more. I have a lot of, just starting to get friends that are, you know, birthing babies, and this is what they're talking about. They're getting that fire in their eye and that ferocity where they will not take no for an answer. You will listen. You will do something about climate change, or you will get out of the way, but you will no longer obstruct them, because their kids are on the line. And if you do obstruct them hard enough, you will go down. They're willing to fight to the bitter end because it's about their kids. And I think that's going to come in a big swell.
It cannot come soon enough to suit me, Paul.
Bob, you're entering your older years. You're supposed to have learned patience.
I'll check. Yeah, I'll be checking into the Buddhist monastery for some rice bowl washing real soon. No, I'm an American of the baby boom generation, Paul. I want my gratification, and I want it instantly.
My generation is going to be the student loan generation, where you have to wait and save up, because I'm making more money, Bob, than I ever have in my life, but because of student loans, and I don't begrudge this at all, though they're too high. I'm one of the lucky ones that can actually make a budget work and live in a place and still eat food. I actually have less monthly budget after bills, because of the student loans. Because the student loans is basically taking about a bigger chunk out, about as much, the extra money I make doing this new job is basically goes to student loans after taxes and everything.
Yeah.
Although I do have health care, so I do have things I didn't have before when I was working. But basically, and all said and done, I'm basically working, breaking even, but I get a work and a job I love. So you learn to be patient. You learn to wait for things. That loan's not going to be there forever. You're going to keep working and get a raise. Things will get better, and you just have to wait. It'll happen.
I need to work on that myself.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I do believe that there will come a time soon that we will realize that we have to do something, or we will become a lost people. And it doesn't matter who has more political points or which party's right or which ideology wins out. It's really only about who is suffering. And that gives me hope, too, because I think that we will come around with that thinking, because the alternative is unthinkable. And people I've talked to, my friends, who are not all progressives, I have mentioned before on the show that I have some fairly conservative friends. I have my parents are conservative, but they're more like Eisenhower Republican conservatives. You know, you can dialogue with them and talk and have conversations and change ideas, which is probably why when I was younger I thought I could do the same to other people, and it didn't work because those types of conservatives are rare, I guess, in conservative land. But they are this generation of 20 to 35 year olds is starting to come around pretty hard to the reality, and they're willing to fight, and they're tired of getting stuff taken from them, and tired of being gamed. And so it'll come around.
I hope so. Listening to you, Paul, I want to know so. And I mean, just the work that we've done inside the 8 campaign, for instance, I know that much as as a historical example, much as New England dragged this country kicking and screaming toward abolition,
yeah,
I think the West Coast of the United States is going to have to be the one that drags America kicking and screaming toward recognizing the reality of climate change and recognizing the viability of alternative sources of energy. Yeah, they've got wind turbines in North Dakota, and they got wind turbines and solar panels in Arizona and Texas, but they've also got essentially hostile governments. It's gonna take that combination of not just non-hostility, but outright advocacy that maybe you can get in California, Oregon, and Washington that convinces the rest of the country that that's the way to go.
All the convincing isn't going to be hard. Those states will work and the other states won't. And don't underestimate the East Coast. I think West Virginia and a lot of other East Coast states can come around, especially since, I mean, environmentally, it's the East Coast that's going to be on the menu first. You know, I mean, rising sea levels will come and that'll hit everybody, but if we don't get on top of it. But what will come first are more and more storms. And the storms hit the Gulf of Mexico. They hit the East Coast a lot more. And, you know, to quote Harry Truman, how many times do you have to be hit in the head with a hammer before you can come around and figure out someone's hitting you? So, same sort of idea. My biggest fear environmentally, and I don't want to scare the porn commune, is if a massive tropical storm hits the Gulf of Mexico and washes all that chemical crud on the bottom of the Gulf.
Yeah, just churns it to the top and sends it ashore.
Sends it ashore right into the water systems, and that stuff is death. That stuff is the chemicals they use. I mean, I didn't get a look at the recipe, but my understanding of that dispersant that they use, it's awful.
Yeah, corrects it.
Awful. Yeah, the reason it's awful, and again, I haven't looked at the structure because it's, you know, trade secreted, but my understanding of basically the chemistry of it is that it's a massive solvent. It can go through polar and nonpolar barriers. Like your skin is a polar barrier. You know, water has a hard time getting in or out, and hence your blood doesn't leak out of your body. But this stuff can go through anything, like a solvent, right into your body, and it will take with it anything it's grabbed on its way, like oil and anything else. So it's just the solvent by itself isn't.
It's a carcinogenic transport mechanism, in essence.
Yeah, basically. Well, I would go beyond carcinogen. It's because you aren't going to die 20 years from now after being exposed from it from lung cancer. You will die in a week, like that swimmer you're talking about that got
swimming
in the ocean every day.
The Darjamal was yeah.
Yeah. You and he's being exposed to the amounts that are going to be not the pure stuff at the bottom, but the amount that is going to be, you know, randomly in the water at the top where he's swimming. This stuff's going to be pure ugh, and it also apparently carries the flesh-eating bacteria.
Right.
So all of that washing up back onto the shores of Mississippi and the beach communities, and you will be dead, and it will be a mess.
Well, do you suppose? Somewhat like the myth of the angel of death visiting Egypt. Do you suppose maybe when that happens to the conservatives that they'll raise enough of an outcry to make a difference, or will their fellow conservatives just tell them that God apparently didn't like them?
I don't know. I think their reaction. I think you'll know from their reaction when it happens. When you know. If they control Mississippi and Mississippi is a right wing state and there is no longer a Mississippi with any people in it because it's a toxic dead zone that's got rising waters, I guess technically they'll be, you know, what will they do? Will they want a new state made to maintain balance, or will they actually think about talking about how to change some of this stuff?
You know, some of this is not speculative, Paul. It's based in the real world. For instance, the other night I was talking about this train that derailed. And it wasn't carrying tar sands oil. It was carrying Bakken crude from North Dakota, apparently. My friend John Wathen, who's been on the program, who's the Hurricane Creek Keeper down in Alabama, informed me of that. But he, much as he... Remember when the coal ash spill happened around Christmas time a few years back up in East Tennessee?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was one of the first on the scene kayaking out on the river looking at what he termed icebergs, if you can imagine, and got in all kinds of trouble.
Like a respirator. Like a respirator, breather, mask, anything.
Yeah. And, well, this train derailed outside Aliceville, Alabama in Pickens County, and somehow or another he got himself a flyover, and he posted an aerial shot of this derailment. And, you know, you read the news story, well, you know, the train derailed and three cars caught fire, full of crude.
So he
posted,
literally.
Anybody who wants to see this can look at my Facebook page. It's just Bob Kincaid over on Facebook. I posted his photograph. It's a derailed train with broken open tank cars and oil just leaching throughout this swamp. And, you know, a swamp is kind of a lung, isn't it?
A sponge would be about another appropriate metaphor, too.
But, I mean, it's gonna take in this stuff, and it's going to spread it throughout the entire watershed.
And it's going to leak it out slowly over hundreds of years.
So, I mean, this stuff really is happening. And by the way, a note came in from Jay that I think this is one for you to field. Jay says, I'm past 70, and I am encouraged by the young people like Paul. But first, what do we have to do to get past the power structure that crushed the Occupy movement?
My only conclusion for that is that business has to be on board, or at least part of business. When it damages certain, you know, the oil companies, you know, are big, but when their profits start cutting into the profits of other big businesses because climate change happenings, the fishing industry for one and a few others, if those businesses don't want to go quietly and know that their way to reclaim their profits is an environmentally sound future, that's when it's a divide-and-conquer strategy, in a sense. Right now, the business front in general is united, lockstep, behind the oil companies. But there is some fracturing. The car companies are beginning to make electric cars. When I was a car salesman in the early 2000s, the scuttlebutt was basically that, and I have no foundation for this. It's just like rumor mill. Water cooler talk. I have no facts to back this up. Let me, you know, start with that. But basically, that back in the 70s and 80s, after the first big fuel shortage, that to keep the oil companies' profits, the oil companies and the auto companies made a backroom deal that basically said, we'll keep gas prices low if you don't invent higher mileage vehicles. And with the gas prices spiking and oil going through the roof and people and the damage that was doing to the car industry basically saw that as a violation of their deal and started really focusing on electric car technology to basically get the oil company's power out of their profits. Because it was hurting them with the high gas prices. No one was buying SUVs, which is car companies are designed to make money off the higher end models, and if everyone wants the fuel efficient model, it can really cut into a car company's profits. Much like if you go to a fast food restaurant and just buy the cheeseburger and don't buy the drink and the fries, where the profit is, it can really cut their profits if everyone just bought the cheeseburger. Same sort of idea. If everyone bought the little fuel efficient sedans, it would really hurt the car companies. So they're basically, and this, like I said, is the scuttlebutt, is basically, we're going to develop electric cars because we're tired of you. You're hurting us. You have way too much power, and it's killing us. So that, I think that's what it's going to happen when basically the power structure itself becomes divided on climate change, because there will be those people who have power in areas where there will be profit in a clean environment, and in the dirty environment, there is no longer business for them, and they will be willing to back up the 99%, or at least be on their side, or at least stop them from being beaten by police so much.
And, you know, I did have the experience I mentioned back in September of riding around a good little bit with Dr. Allen down in Central Texas in his Chevy Volt. And I came away from that experience converted. sold, yeah. Believer.
Yeah.
That's a magnificent automobile. I think the idea behind it is even advanced beyond anything that's going into the Prius, for instance.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I think our buddy Ray, who transplanted from Michigan to Florida, Ray and Kim, they have a Volt as well. And they have nothing but good to say about it.
Yeah, and I'm driving this 1995 Mazda Protege that I'm the original owner of, and looking to possibly trade up into a Volt or when maybe in a few more years or the prices come down, one of those Teslas.
Right.
Yep. But and so I hope that answers who sent the email in?
Jay. That was Jay.
Yeah, I hope that answers Jay's question. The business community will change gears because they can only eat us for so long. Then they have to start eating each other for profits, and that's when it happens.
That's in the very essential nature of capitalism, isn't it?
Basically, that is the cycle. They go too big, they begin to eat each other, and when they're trying to eat each other, they fall back into smaller businesses, and the economy reshakes itself.
Oh, by the way, Paul, News Ninja Gene ran out and got us the Gandhi quote in the right order. We were both wrong.
Oh!
First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And News Ninja Gene adds personal edit and take every last penny from them.
Fair enough. And then the last thing that, to close out the conversation here, the last thing that gives me hope is, hey, if the Seattle Seahawks are going to win the Super Bowl this year, which they just might, anything's possible.
That's absolutely true. And another big win up in that area today, the suburb where SeaTac Airport is.
Uh-huh.
Passed a $15 minimum wage for the airport employees.
Oh, I've got a friend that works in that airport, so I should let him know and see if he's part of it.
And you know what'll be interesting, because anything in an airport. Of course, I never go in the shops. I couldn't afford to buy a T-shirt in an airport shop, but you know, I get the occasional hot dog, and of course, it's an $8 hot dog. It's already an $8 hot dog. You can't tell me that there's not a humongous profit margin built in there already.
Is that a more expensive hot dog than at a ballpark?
Airport hot dogs can be more expensive than, say, a hot dog at Fenway, which I think is the most expensive hot dog in America in an American ballpark.
Ooh. We're gonna have to get folks from Boston to confirm that one.
Yeah. But then again, they're not exactly giving them away for cheap at the Nationals ballpark in D.C. either.
No.
And those are the two that I've been in most recently in the last couple of years. But, Paul, thank you very much for everything that you brought to the table this evening. Even though we don't hear from you a whole lot, when you do call in, you surely do make it count. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. And have a happy Thanksgiving. And, you know, if you really feel the need to come broadcast for the Horn family tomorrow, do. But please, you know, take the time to enjoy your core family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the one difference that it makes, though, here is that I am, I have to take into account that I get to work from home. This studio is in the back of the mansion, drafty and wet though it may be. So we are together almost constantly. So if it's an act of solidarity, if I decide to do it, if it's an act of solidarity with people who are being abused by the corporate profiteering, for me to be here and, you know, maybe even provide an outlet for people to maybe call in and talk about it, then I think there's a certain value in that, don't you?
Yeah, I do. You have a good night, Bob, and I'll let someone else get on the line.
All right, thanks very much, Paul, and we've got good news here between you and Dr. John's challenge. It's been met to the tune of $75 worth so far, so that's a really big deal.
That's great. Well, Dr. John's challenge is finished, and please finish out my and Horn family so that Bob can rest a little easier tonight.
Thanks, Paul, and you drive carefully, and our best to your family.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thanks.
Paul from Parts Unknown. wonderful conversation to get us started on this Wednesday evening. And yeah, thanks everybody who to everyone who has stepped up and met Dr. John's and Paul's challenges. Thanks to Grant. Thanks to Ron. Thanks to Sal. And thanks to Sylvia. And thanks to Danny. We are well on the way. In fact, I just realized we are past Paul's challenge now too. And about $25 to the good if people want to keep this rolling, because like I said, we finish November on Friday, and we are somewhere between $700 and $1,000 in the hole. And frankly, bills are there to be paid. So if we can keep this momentum going, it would be wonderful. And thanks to Dr. John and to Paul for getting the ball rolling. Okay, a little economics here, I think. Irish Dave. Bob, there are no $8 hot dogs. I've eaten a lot of hot dogs, and that's a $1 hot dog. Oh, sure, they charge $8, but it's just a wiener, which, incidentally, you do not wish to see made. Just say it. Thanks, Dave. Perspective. Perspective is everything. So the lines are open, 304-658-3333. On the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact number. If you've never reached out that way, just send me a contact request, and I will act upon it, approve it, and you'll be hooked up to make contact whenever you may so choose. And let me throw something out there for your consideration, because it is in the talking phases. I don't know exactly when we'll be able to do it, but I want to be a part of that hopeful, and I want the Horn Family Commune to be a part of that hopeful future. And I think I've mentioned it before, but I do welcome your input on this. I'm actually in conversations with someone who is being very helpful on the technical end of this. The Horn has been operating on the same equipment for about 8 years now. It's not going to last forever. It wasn't meant to. And so we've been talking a lot about a Kickstarter campaign. I'll admit, I was inspired by what Mike and Kathy Malloy were able to accomplish with the help of the Truth Seekers. And I want when it comes around, when we get it set up, I'll beat on it like a little tin drum, and hopefully we'll get people sharing it out far and wide and get huge participation, because I have a goal, and it is I don't think it's an unrealistic goal. I have talked for years, and you've heard me talk about mountaintop removal and coal-fired electricity. And it has long been our ambition to be able to say and be the only progressive, and God knows there's none that are conservative that would do this, or right-wing, or Republican, or teabagger, or whatever you would care to call them, but to be the only program that can say no mountains were blown up, no communities were poisoned in the making of this program. So that's where we're going. I don't know what the timing of it's going to be, because I think it would probably be disastrous in December, and January is a very, very bad time too, and probably up into February. Hell, maybe it's March. I don't know. But that's something for us to think about down the road and into the future. We're going to find a way. And it would be great if it was wind and solar, you know, because quite often when the sun's not shining, the wind is blowing. It just happens to work out that way. It would be a great stride forward to be able to say that. So I welcome your input on that idea. And so here at 14 minutes past the hour, three lines open, 304-658-3333, and some folks on hold. If you're on hold, please stay that way. Take a little break, and hopefully line up the queue for this this night before Thanksgiving conversation. Because after all, it's conversation radio what we do here. Listener supported, and certainly non-commercial. This is the Horn. Flying out across the big blue. British band singing a song called Calling America, it seems only fitting that we go to an email. Hi, I'm Bob. This is Wednesday night, night before Thanksgiving. It seems only fitting that we go to an email from Australia. Robert writing in, subject line, based on some of the stuff Paul and I were talking about. Subject line, coal and solar and religious radio. Hi, Bob. Hi, Robert. Sorry to disappoint, but here in Oz, one coal-fired power station is experimenting with using solar hot water systems to preheat the water before it goes into the boilers, the aim being to reduce the amount of coal that needs to be burnt to heat the water. Not great, but it's something, I guess. Yeah, okay, anybody? Anybody want to work on a simile for me here? Chat room, anybody? That's like using a artisanally crafted razor to butcher the Easter Bunny. I don't know if that works or not. But Robert continues, by the way, it is estimated that 50 square kilometers of solar panels could supply Australia with all the power it needs. We have lots of desert and lots of rooftops. Oh, yes, absolutely. And if it only takes, can you imagine an Australia, and you don't want to just do it to every bit, but what if you do 100 square kilometers, 200 square kilometers, 300, 400, 500, 1,000 square kilometers of solar panels? Hey, look, you're in the energy business, and you're selling it elsewhere onto a modern 21st century grid. There, see, that's that optimism, that's that hopefulness that Paul is talking about. How do you not make money on that? Well, here's the sober sides of it. Robert continues, sadly, it seems we have to wait for the short-sighted dinosaurs. Short arm, too. You ever seen a T-Rex? One of the things that makes Ferg laugh the hardest is a graphic he once saw that said, you think you're having a bad day? Try being a T-Rex trying to make a bed. It was a visual. He still laughs. Robert says, sadly, it seems we have to wait for the short-sighted dinosaurs that run the federal and state government to die off before anything like a solar power station happens. They always want to wait for more data or someone else to do it first, which is why Sydney has been waiting for a second airport since the 1970s. And as Robert mentioned in a previous email, instead they just keep extending the runways out into Botany Bay. What a great idea! As to religious broadcasting, Robert says, I'm not aware of any religiously based radio stations in Australia that only broadcast religious content 24/7. We do get a couple of religious TV ministers on community TV, but only on Sunday morning, and they're preaching to the choir. Do not assume that the status quo will remain as such, Robert. We must be always on guard. Irish Dave pointing out in regard to Robert's note, Gina Reinhart would be again it, speaking of dinosaurs. And Shorty in L.A. says, Bob, please tell all the Horn family happy holidays from me. I say holidays since Thanksgiving and Hanukkah fall on the same day. Never give up. Never give in. And I couldn't agree more. And thanks for the reminder that it's Hanukkah. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So happy Hanukkah, happy holidays, happy Thanksgiving, and happy about a month, less than a month from now, happy celebration of the birth of the god Mithras from the Virgin, because that's where it started. Mussolini and Bill O'Reilly be damned. Yeah, Irish Dave pointing out the solar heated water for the coal fired boiler. That would be GMO coal power then. Yeah, kinda. And I got to share something with you before we do go back to the phones. Something charming just happened here in the studio. Ferg and I often sate our urges to see the rest of the world with travel logs and documentaries and stuff that we can watch online. And it just so happened because he badly wants to see these places. It just so happened that I showed him the Tony Bourdain No Reservations episode about Rome. And so he's sitting there watching, and he sees this classic Roman dish that's basically pasta, a little bit of butter, and freshly cracked pepper and Parmesan cheese. And it's something di pepe, and pepe meaning pepper in Italiano. And he said, I said, well, son, we got all the makings for it. He said, get the mortar and pestle out, get the whole peppercorns out, crush some up, none of that crap out of the box. He said, I'm going to do it, Dad. You think I can do it? I think you can do it, son. So while part of the reason that there was a song playing was because Ferg had walked back here with a plate of that creation. And it's one of those simple, it's simple, but it's elegant, and it's magnificent. And he did it to a T. It's beautiful. It's fragrant. Delicious, and I'm really proud of him. It's a kind of a wistful thing to watch children grow up, but it's also a really, really cool thing when they come back and they do something like that. Not that I gauge how cool something is based upon how yummy it is or whether my son has, you know, worked to provide me food, but it's beautiful to see them take initiative and be responsible enough, and I'll bet, little wager, I'll bet he even washes the dishes he cooked in. And that's one of those big ones. So, yeah, little happy moments. Grievance coming in from Irish Dave. You forgot Festivus for the rest of us. Thanks for the reminder. So here at 24 minutes past the hour and doing beautiful things happening with fundraising this evening, thanks very much, Diane, for jumping in. Diane has answered the call. And we're just treating each answering of the call as being a challenge rolling forward. Diane, let's see, Diane answered, Diane answered Danny. So now Diane's contribution is on the clock for someone who would like to answer her. And thank you very, very much. Because there are bad things in the offing that could happen if we don't get to the end of the month, okay. So, to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Eek.
Well, hey, Eek.
Anyway, I was thinking, when I was a child, you couldn't go to the grocery store and buy a turkey. So there was a fellow there in Carteret County, North Carolina, that raised wild turkeys. I don't know how he got started, but he did. And so we would buy this turkey and put it out in the chicken yard and trim the wing feathers on one wing so it couldn't fly out, because turkeys can fly. I've seen them fly through a Pocosin, for heaven's sakes. Anyway, then when came time for Thanksgiving, I was just crushed because I'd made a pet of the turkey.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
How do you make a pet of the turkey? They're not particularly social or friendly creatures, though, are they, Edward?
No, but I made a pet of them. Anyway, Cousin Edna's family had this turkey. It was a pet. His name was Hezekiah. And they had other birds, too. They had old peacocks and everything. The peacocks were beautiful, and they would sleep up in the pecan trees around the house, but they have a horrible voice. They sound like they're hollering help. Help, 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 in the middle of the night. Anyway.
As well they might have been.
Yeah. Anyway, they had this turkey, pet turkey, and his name was Hezekiah, and he weighed about 30 to 35 pounds. So they decided that they really needed to cook Hezekiah for Thanksgiving. But they couldn't do it themselves, so they hired this neighbor to do it, and they gave him half of the turkey. So they baked their half of the turkey, set it out on the table, and there was Cousin Edna and all her family. She had seven children and all the grandchildren and everything. There at the dining table. and they all sat down and started to cry. They could not eat one bite. So they took poor, what was the remains of poor Hezekiah out and buried him under the grapevine.
No mercy.
Isn't that a horrible Thanksgiving story?
Well, and charming into the bargain, too, though, Edward.
Oh, well.
And unintentionally vegan Thanksgiving.
Well, see, we're vegans. And because my partner had a heart attack about 2.5 years ago and went on a vegan diet, and his heart doctor told him that he had never seen anybody lower their triglycerides or cholesterol like he had on a diet.
You know, there are awfully compelling reasons for that kind of diet. You know who Dennis Kucinich is, of course.
Yes.
He had Crohn's disease and switched to a vegan diet, and it's all, you know, it all went away.
My word, then Crohn's is not, oh, that's something else. Ooh-wee.
Yeah.
That's the other name for it is ulcerated colitis.
Right.
I'll get it out.
Right, and those of us who misheard the Beatles know that the girl with colitis goes by in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, right?
Oh, God. I don't think. Oh, mercy. Whatever. Poor Lucy.
Well, I certainly hope. And, you know, it's funny you mention it. For me, the turkey, the Thanksgiving was never about the turkey.
No, it wasn't us either. We'd have a nice dinner and stuff like that, but sometimes it was pork, sometimes it was chicken, sometimes it was turkey.
Well, but for me, as a kid growing up, there were the homemade mashed potatoes, but the two things that I remember and that we perpetuate still are from my mother's and her mother's before her, and as far as I know, her mother's before her Thanksgiving mm-hmm. table, were the dressing and the sweet potato croquettes.
Well, let me tell you, dressing is my favorite thing, and sweet potato pie is one of my favorites. And my great-grandfather went up to New Bern, North Carolina, on some business, and his two grandsons took him up there, and they were identical twins, Otis and Otto, and they took him to this restaurant for lunch, and this fella was a Syrian fella, and my granddaddy had known him for years, and they were friends. And so after they had their lunch, this friend came over, the Syrian fella, and said, "Well, how was it, Sam?" And Sam said, "Oh, it was great." And said the fella said, "Well, would you like some dessert? I have some pie." And "What kind of pie would you like?" And my great-granddaddy said, "What other kind of pie is there except sweet potato?" And this friend said, "Oh, I don't eat sweet potato pie." And my great-granddaddy said, "Why?" And the Syrian fellow said, "Well, it makes me fart." And my great-granddaddy said, "Well, it makes me fart too, but I eat it anyway." And his friend said, no, Sam, not fart poo-poo, fart big.
It's beautiful, though.
It was
it's
a long
just
time
beautiful.
Ago. Take care.
You never cease to delight, Edward. the fact that you had relatives named Otis and Otto. I swear, I joined the rest of the Horn family commune in begging you to commit some of these stories to paper. Please.
Well, I adored both of them, and nobody in town could tell them apart but me. I could tell them apart.
One answered to Otis. No, I kid, but we love your stories, and I hope you and your partner have a magnificent, magnificent feast tomorrow.
Well, we're not. Because of his vegan diet, we have...
Oh, I'll bet by the time the program's over, you will have any number of vegan recipes sitting in my inbox here. For a perfectly wonderful Thanksgiving.
Well, we broke down, and we are having a slice of pecan pie with French vanilla ice cream bluebell on top of it.
Oh, see, now, darn it, I can't get bluebell ice cream up here. Blue Bunny, yes. Bluebell, no. But that bluebell French vanilla ice cream is magnificent.
You're damn telling me. Oh, Lord, I love it.
Yep. Take it by the bathtub full.
Oh. Well, you take care. You have a very happy Thanksgiving, and all of the Horn people have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Edward. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, and watch out for eating that sweet potato pie. You know what it'll do to you.
Make you fat.
Mm-hmm. Make you fat.
Exactly. Bye now.
Bye.
Oh, that's Edward calling from Dallas. Okay, so you've been warned about the sweet potato pie, right? Right. And before I do go back to the phones, just... Oh, one little Thanksgiving obligation that we absolutely have to deal with. It just takes a few minutes. I no longer play Alice's Restaurant on the night before Thanksgiving once I found out that Arlo Guthrie had gone over to the dark side. And for all I know, maybe some of these folks did too. But this show was always precious to me, and it has become my other Thanksgiving tradition because I'll watch this two or three times in the next couple of days. And not like a turkey, but I will cackle like a hen laying eggs. Because there's just so much reality to it. So, yeah, your holiday tradition.
And I think I hear something now. The crowd is moving out into the parking area. And, oh yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter. And it's coming this way.
A helicopter?
It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner, and it says, Happy Thanksgiving from W-K-R-P. What a sight, ladies and gentlemen. What a sight. Seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver plummeting to the earth from only 2,000 feet into the air. The third. It's no parachutes yet.
Happy skydivers. I can't tell just yet what they are, but...
Oh, my God, they're talking! Crashing to the earth right in front of our eyes. I just went to the windshield of a parked car. Is this running around pushing each other? Oh, my goodness. Oh, the humanity. People are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. I don't know how much longer the crowd is running for their lives. I think I'm going to step inside. I can't stay out here and watch this anymore. No, I can't go in there.
Hold
my position here, Johnny. The crowd.
Les, are you there? Les isn't there. Thanks for that on-the-spot report, Les. You just tuned in. The Pinedale Shopping Mall has just been bombed with live turkey. Film at 11.
Should have worked.
Can I help you?
No, I'm fine. Sir?
It was the most unusual promotion idea I ever heard of. Never been anything else like it.
No, I don't suppose there has.
I thought it would work. I planned this thing right down to the last detail. It was perfect.
Where'd you get those birds?
Are you okay?
I don't know. A man and his two children tried to kill me. After the turkeys hit the pavement, the crowd kind of scattered, but some of them tried to attack me. I had to
jam myself into a phone booth.
Then Mr. Carlson had the helicopter land in the middle of the parking lot. I guess he thought he could save the day by turning the rest of the turkeys loose. It's pretty strange after that.
Strange.
You're right.
No, Les, come on now, tell us the rest.
I really don't know how to describe it. It was like the turkeys mounted a counterattack. It was almost as if they were organized.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
Yes. Yes. And Edward reminded me of that because, you know, turkeys can fly. Out of, well, helicopters? Hmm. And then Irish Dave knows, how did they get WKRP, wee crap, past the network standards and practices? Well, they're not always just so bright, are they? And Irish Dave also noting, Edward, turkey fots are the worst. Ron in Raleigh notes that, he said, I wanted to get to you sooner, but I was busy picking greens for tomorrow. As you might remember, I work at the steam plant at North Carolina State University. We have a solar cogeneration plant to preheat boiler feed water. So yes, dirty tech and clean tech existing side by side. As an aside, Spain has a pilot solar plant that has run for 6 months. It uses enteric salts, which melt at fairly low temperatures during the day and re-solidify at night, giving off its heat. So much for solar not being a viable energy technology. So much indeed. Thanks, Ron and Raleigh. And speaking of Spain, a little reminder, something that, this is damned interesting. So there's this guy named Bill Williams, and he's the president of GTAC, Gogebic Taconite, up there in, he actually lives in Michigan, I think, but these are the people that want to blow up the Pinokies, right? Bill Williams has been charged as part of a copper mining scheme in Spain by that country's government with crimes against the community and crimes against the environment. Can anybody say extradition? Yeah. And Luda with an email. Hey, Bob, any chance I can get you to refer to Thanksgiving as the white, as what the native community calls it, Kick a Pilgrim Day? All in good fun, Bob. Happy Kick a Pilgrim Day to all the Horn listeners. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Because the fact of the matter is, I was rolling through my Facebook feed the other day and ran across some guy saying, what do Native Americans do on Thanksgiving Day? And just because I'm a smartass and had no business answering it for anybody, but just, you know, I just typed it, grieve. This, and again, I will take what Luda offers as a sort of an opening and an okay for me to make this observation. To the extent that it has anything to do with the early colonization of this continent by white Europeans, it's not a hell of a lot to celebrate if you are from among those people who were here first. It would be like celebrating genocide. Because, you know, the diseases got off the boat with the white people. It's not like the pilgrims got off the boat and had recently bathed. No, they came ashore along with the rats and the other vermin and the fleas and the filth and everything that came with white European society. And in short order before, I mean, remember, there were native communities wiped out by white European disease that had never even so much as set eyes on a white European person. In line with what Luda wrote, Irish Dave points out, overheard at the first Thanksgiving, you know, we got to tighten up the immigration laws. But once again, a philosophy that says that we are all children of the same planet and the same life-giving force, whatever that may be, said had Native people looking at the poor, starving, stupid white people who were more concerned with their godforsaken religion than they were with actually making it through the winter and saying, we can't just let these people die. when it may very well have been the best decision they could have made. So there. Yeah. Jeremy, by the way, with a plea. Bob, please stop with the food porn. I haven't eaten dinner yet, and I still have a while before I get to. Turkey and dressing. Yeah, see, I think tomorrow we'll probably forego the turkey because we'd have to smoke it anyway. And while I don't, you know, running the smoker in the dead of winter doesn't bother me, but I don't know. I'm just going to make up the dressing and the mashed potatoes and maybe the sweet potato croquettes and go with that. Because that's what everybody goes for. The turkey is an afterthought. And the dressing's really simple. White bread kind of dried out in the oven. Pan of biscuits. Cornbread. Chopped celery. Chopped onion. Salt. Pepper. Broth of some sort. And sage. And it's a miracle that any of it ever gets into the pan to bake, because everybody's constantly through the kitchen going, I want some more of it now. So long ago I figured out the smart money is to make enough for three pans and figure I'll be lucky if I get two into the oven. And it's dressing for the next two or three days in absolute bliss. And this is, you know, that's another family tradition. Every time, this time of year, everybody looks at everybody else and goes, why don't we have this more often? And you know what? Stovetop stuffing can bite me. It is not the same. Blech. I hate that stuff. Yeah. And then the sweet potato croquettes, which is nothing but mashed up sweet potatoes with a little bit of brown sugar and maybe some pineapple added in, wrapped around a marshmallow, dipped in butter, and rolled through cornflakes, crumbs, and baked. And yeah, those are gone. They don't get cold. They're gone before the pan has fully lost its heat. Shorty in L.A. pointing out, the Native Americans did the same as the Africans. They were unaware when they fed the foreigners a good meal that the dessert would be their murder and genocide. Yeah. Back to the phones. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. Lots of stories on the table, too, but, well, I'm right fond of the conversation. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Oh, man, a lot. I got a good call this morning. There's a certain apartment building wants me to move in there.
Ah, very nice.
Let's hope it works, since it's loaded with other harmonic racketeers, musicians of different types. So we'll see about that. And Paul had it right tonight. I hope he sure does. That eventually these people are going to catch on. But you know, it sure took them, average American middle class person, a long time to catch on to the fact that the anti-Vietnam crowd was correct. It was when their kids started coming home and telling them what they had seen,
or not telling them, as the case may be.
Yeah, or sometimes
because they were unable.
Unable to talk about it at all. Yeah, it's never an easy thing to talk about, I'm sure. I mean, I've seen a few things that I've been involved in that, you know, nowhere close to that. But sometimes were things that I don't want to talk about anymore. And Paul, I hope you're right. You know, because it'll be after I'm gone. But hell, I'll be somewhere looking for it to be in readable form. To see what's going on. And tomorrow I'm as soon as I'm done here, I got to go shave my face and clean up my act, because I'm going to be with some nice people tomorrow, and how much I appreciate it.
And I bet you that's going to be a wonderful table too.
Oh, the DC folks are fine. Fine people. The Horn group, I've heard anybody that's, once in a while you'll get a caller who is kind of still up, still optimistically thinks you can change certain people with feeding them decency long enough. But some of them have to be force-fed. Now, what you were talking about with this heating the water with solar power, or partially, well, why not totally? Because I'm a big believer, having grown up in a place where we had steam heat. The heat was very, very efficient radiators. Of course, it was coal-fired.
Right, but the argument goes, Bill, that, well, we can't go totally to solar because what about night? And it has to do with things like battery technologies. And see, but those are the places where technology, and like what I was talking about with Paul, those are the places where technology can and will fill in the gaps. Battery technology is going to get better. Storage technology is going to get better. Transmission technology is going to get better. Those are engineering problems that are not insurmountable. Re-engineering the atmosphere so that we can burn every last godforsaken molecule of hydrocarbons is.
Yeah. And I don't know, Bob, what do you really think about hydrocarbons? You think they're running low on oil, or is that...
Sure they are. That's the only way that the incredibly tormented process that is involved with turning tar sands into a goo that will move through a pipeline to Houston, Texas, that's the only way that it becomes economically viable, is if it's economically feasible to produce. Because and the thing is, all of these extreme extraction technologies, be it mountaintop removal, hydrofracking, or the tar sands, were all predicted within the paradigm of peak oil, gas, coal. Okay, Appalachia passed peak coal a long damn time ago, and that's why we're blowing up mountains here. Now, granted, we're producing more coal with less human beings via mountaintop removal than West Virginia has ever produced, even in its boom days.
Even with the most people working it.
Right.
You know, at least eating off of their work. I mean, there's some justification, because a lot of people who couldn't make a living any other way made a living doing this or that, as long as it was legal. It was semi. It wasn't moral, for sure, but it was a job. And that's what they're still saying, telling people it's a job, but it's reached a point where it's...
But the jobs are negligible.
Yes.
Okay, there are more... Okay, since it's the night before Thanksgiving, or kick a pilgrim in the butt day, there are more Walmart workers in West Virginia than there are mountaintop removal workers. There are more cops, there are more nurses, there are more florists, there are more undertakers in this state than there are mountaintop removal workers, and yet these fools stand there, well, we're driving the engine of the West Virginia economy, and we can't do without coal.
Yeah, right.
A certain contingent of them are just stupid. Another contingent of them are bald-faced liars. Because again, concepts of peak, you know, which means that, you know, you reach a peak amount of production and then you start down the other side of the bell curve, and it gets harder to produce and more scarce, and you have to do more extreme things to get it out of the ground and get it into the stream of commerce. Well, that's what all of this is.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason, for instance, that Saudi Arabia is looking to huge solar farms in their deserts, because they know their oil is going away. And there's a reason that that China, for as polluted as they have managed to make their country with coal-fired electricity and coal-fired this and coal-fired plants and yada yada yada, that they are building as many wind farms as they possibly can. China is actually trying harder to transition away from hydrocarbons than we are.
Well, they have to eventually. There's limits, and one of my friends who went to grade school, he was a grade behind me in school, a smart boy, and he had more perseverance than I did, and he got his bachelor's, and And in fact, he got his bachelor's because somebody helped pay his graduation costs as a gift. Because he didn't have the money to pay his graduation price fees. Pretty smart boy. And then he went to, I think, Case for a master's, which he never worked in the field of any sciences, but he was talking about what we would call fracking. He was talking about this 30 years ago. So this stuff's been around for a while.
Sure.
And the poisonous removal of this stuff is, I wonder what it's going to do. Because I know what strip mining did in Ohio. It, at least the miners had enough sense or whatever, or their boss were. There's a bunch of good fishing and camping areas in what had been strip mining. They turned them in, basically turned it into ponds and small lakes and stock them with fish. And I forget the name of it. It's in southern Ohio. And by the way, if somebody would... one of the numbers that Jim sent to me, all I get there is a fax line on one end, so I'll have to try that. But I'm not having any real problems yet, but yeah, they're pushing me about getting out of here.
Well, look, as soon as you get set up in new digs, and I know this will not be lost on you since you are the student of history that you are, once you get set up in your new digs, the last order of business will be what the ancients used to refer to as the Parthian shot.
Oh, yeah, that's always good.
And make a pin cushion out of those asshats, Bill.
Well, I'll try. Well, you know what? What I found out, and one of our other family members would back me up on this, that you know that you think of this this long time Society for the Blind.
Yeah.
Society of bullshit. It's a society that employs a lot of social workers, and not a lot, but a few, and then they get you involved with that. They want to get you involved in social functions, square dancing, and blah, 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 you know. How about survival? I liked square dancing when I was 13, when I first did it. It was fun. Because actually, you could dance with a female and not be embarrassed to death, you know. That was the good thing about it. It was pretty simple to follow the directions of the caller.
I'm just going to ask this, Bill, because, I mean, you're always good for a one-liner and stuff, and once you can take the front man off the bandstand, but you can't take the bandstand out of the front man.
Can't.
So you're good for a zinger or a quip or a funny or a cute one here.
Well, I've heard them all.
But no, honest to God, I got to stop you. Have these advocates for the blind really encouraged you to square dance?
Well, they do it. I know people who are real social members of it, which is good for them because it does bring them into the... But this thing hit me so late in life. I mean, when you're 58, you're past a lot. I mean, I played for another 8 or 9 years, you know, because the guy that was working for me was I was working for him, and I still had a big enough reputation to be... to help pull people through the door, and you know that's the name of the job. I know so many bands that go out and play, and one of the nurses who comes and refills my meds, her husband plays in a band, and she said they played a place not far from where I'm at now. She said they had about 3 people, because that's how it is right now. People are afraid to go out to a bar, because if you're out at closing time, when you get out there at closing time, you might as well paint a target on your butt, because they're going to pull you over. Because nobody likes drunk drivers, for Christ's sake. But I have a theory that I wish somebody could follow up mathematically. A lot of these times when whole families are wiped out by drunks, what time of the day or night was it? I have a feeling that a lot of that kind of stuff happens before 9 o'clock at night. Because a lot of families are, you know, they're off the road at 9 o'clock. If they're traveling on vacation and such, they're in a motel somewhere. It doesn't make it any nicer. But you wonder why statistically, you know?
Yeah.
Just because these cops are like, you know, after bar closing hours, they just sit there. That's the easiest money they make in this world. And I just have a mistrust for small-time local politics. I had a guy grab me after I'd been fishing. Bass fishing was something that you did in August. You didn't hit the water till 9 o'clock at night, and you got off at 4 a.m. because that's when the bass were out feeding, was late at night. So I had picked up a Jack Russell Terrier that had been running around and had no place to go, so he jumped in my truck. And so we come to a village square, and the stop sign is laying on its side on the ground. I could see it. I was up in a big pickup truck. I could see it. So I stopped, and as I made my next move, here comes a cop. His baseball cap said he was a cop, so he must have been a real cop. Baseball cap and all. And he gets me to a place where he can relieve $40 or $50 from me. And away I go home, you know. In other words, there's a lot of this crap that goes on with speed traps. And they grabbed my uncle one time with radar. But the uncle, being hip to electronics, he knew that the law was that radar was supposed to be, what's the word I'm looking for? When they qualify it, it had to be tested every day and recertified and reset before they took it on the road. And they hadn't done that, and my uncle hit him back with that. He said, when was this thing certified? And the judge let him go off the door. So in other words, to me, a lot of this stuff, although it theoretically the most nastiest thing in the world is a drunk driver. God knows I had to dodge a few in my time. And I didn't like it either. But this becomes a source of revenue as much as it is everything else.
Sure it is. Sure it is. In cities that are vastly underfunded, DUIs where fines can raise. Look, other countries deal with DUI as well, but they don't insist on incarcerating people, and they try to get them help for what may or may not be a drinking problem.
And they don't treat it
as a revenue stream.
Yeah.
I go back to something, you know, you talking about the accidents and whatnot. A friend of mine many years ago pointed something out, and it was back when there was a statistic that something like 48% of all highway traffic fatalities were caused by drunk drivers. And he looked at me and said, "You know what that means?" And I said, "What?" He means, "That means 52% are caused by sober people."
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Because I can't justify people. I've seen people stagger out of bars, and which is why I love the camper. I could get in the thing at the... talking about 1950. We get a storm here in Cleveland, a snowstorm. And being 7 years old, I remember how horrifying. It was like 20-some inches of snow, and that was quite a thing when you're 7 years old to see that happen. I remember armored vehicles going to a big commercial dairy not far from the house and hauling trailers of milk to stores all over the city because they couldn't get through any other way. Well, the streetcars, they could put the plow cars out and had that part of it cleared pretty quick, so public transportation was back working. But, the plowing the stuff and salting. We have a huge salt mine in the Cleveland area, one out in Painesville, Ohio, out on the Grand River. And I often wonder what they're doing to the substructure of the earth with these big salt mines. I don't know if they're helping that too much. Hell, we've had earthquakes.
Well, there were, there was a story just last week about a vast sinkhole opening in Florida again. And, of course, there's that humongous sinkhole that's opened, I guess, where there was a bunch of drilling that went on in the past in Louisiana.
Yep.
And, of course, there are massive salt domes under the ground there as well. But, again, but all of those things, Bill, go back to this concept that we have. Because, of course, money comes first, that what we will do is we'll go ahead and allow industry to do pernicious, toxic thing X, and then we'll see if anybody gets poisoned or died, and if they do or did, then we'll turn around and start looking for somebody else to blame, claim act of God, or anything to make sure that the flow of money is unimpeded, even if the flow of death becomes like an onrushing torrent.
Well, I was listening to a radio show out of Minneapolis, they're Twin Cities, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they want to go back up to the Mesabi Iron Range, and on the the border waters, which a lot of fishermen love to fish. Me, I didn't like it. Carrying a canoe around didn't sound like a vacation to me. I'm sorry, I wasn't that big an outdoors guy. I did love electric motors because then you could really sneak up on the little bastards with those things. He didn't scare them, but because there's a big debate going on up there because some companies want to go in there, international companies, of course, and they want to start reworking basically the Iron Range, and because there's something else up there they found they can use. And
Lord knows, up there along the basin of the St. Louis River, that river has been turned into a toxic nightmare. There are mesothelioma clusters up there that just won't quit. Horrible sicknesses among the people who worked in those open pit iron mines.
Yeah.
And they serve as a sort of a bellwether for people who are resisting this disgusting open pit mine in Wisconsin, because that's what's headed for them.
Yeah.
And my word, Bill, it is a beautiful area. Now, it's not mountains like I know mountains, and of course I'm sitting here acting like, and there are people sitting in Colorado or New Mexico or Idaho or Utah or Montana going, oh, he thinks he knows mountains. No, these are mountains.
Well, I always...
They're elevated enough that they will have to use, that the company would have to use mountaintop removal techniques to get at them, to get at the ores. And once that happens, and the particulate, ultrafine particulates go into the air, and the toxins go into the water, it's game over. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to. What have any of these extractive industries, these extreme extractive industries, what have they ever done to earn any given community's trust?
Well,
why is it that trust has to be given trust has to be given in the dark, but the poisoning gets done in broad daylight?
Yeah, and they did employ people, but so what? They were also killing them at the same time. The steel mills I remember seeing from my place. I grew up in a historic neighborhood. It was that housing project that had been opened by Mrs. Roosevelt herself. She opened two in one day, and in keeping with the American way of life, there was one on East 55th Street that had black Americans primarily, and the other one was mixed. So at least it was. Then a year later, they opened one down on the lakefront that was Irish. They spread the stuff around in those days, and built new places. But you can't keep up with this stuff. I don't know how the hell you guys do it. Because every time you turn around, because this discussion this morning out of that's a strong left wing station. They have some local guys first up, and before that they have
Amy Goodman.
Yeah, who was broadcasting from a conference in the Philippines. And there's a lot of people angry there about what they're doing to the...
Right, well, the people in the Philippines right now, after Typhoon Haiyan, feel like that they have been forgotten by the entire world.
Yeah.
And to a certain... I feel a share of a sense of guilt in that, because while we sit here talking about the various and sundry things that all have merit for discussion, well, how much information has gotten out there about the after effects of high on.
Yeah. And outside of food and water and medical care.
And we're talking about a crisis that is going to endure for years.
Years, yeah.
And from which they may not fully recover.
Well,
and from which some people cannot recover because they're all busy being dead.
Yeah. And New Orleans has not recovered yet, although...
New Orleans was not intended to recover.
Built, you know, building there, except along the bank of the river, the high, you know, where the little narrow area that the French settled was, the rest there was always potentially a death trap. Especially if you don't control the flooding and the, because Pontchartrain was there for years, and I think that's where the dams burst and the pumps didn't work, and, in other words, man-made technology could not fight back against...
Well, let's not forget that the Army Corps of Engineers, where Katrina was concerned,
yep.
The Army Corps of Engineers have been repeatedly warned that the levees that protected the Ninth Ward were woefully inadequate to the task. Not only could they not withstand a Cat 5, they could not withstand a Cat 4, and possibly couldn't withstand a Cat 3.
Yeah.
So those were deliberate choices that were made.
Yeah, we've got money for fighting all over the world to protect business interests, and nothing and I'll tell you, Bob, the rise of SMAC in northern Ohio has been tremendous, and to me, the logical place to point at is Afghanistan.
Well, not just that, Bill. Not just that. I saw a story the other day about a sheriff, you know, the high sheriff, the elected sheriff of one county in Ohio, where this god-awful concoction that has come over from Russia called crocodile.
Oh yeah, that's man-made crap.
Has emerged. I mean, it's one of those codone derivatives. But the thing is, you can cook it in a bathtub the way idiots cook meth.
Yep.
And it uses a lot of pernicious chemicals, and is called crocodile. Crocodile, because it eats your flesh.
Oh.
And, for instance, injection sites for it become scaly like a lizard's skin. But it literally eats flesh from the inside out. Flesh becomes necrotic as a result of the use of this stuff because of the way that it's manufactured. And one sheriff in Ohio, I do believe, went so far as to put out a public warning. He said, listen, I would like to think that nobody will ever use heroin. But he said, I'm a realist who lives in a real world, and so I'm saying this right now. If you're doing this stuff, make sure you trust your dealer, only get clean stuff, and if you think you've got any of this crocodile, bring it to us. We badly need to chemically analyze it and find out what it is, what it's made of, and there will be no questions asked.
Yeah. Well, that's a decent piece of work from a
Well, for a cop, that's damn near Albert Schweitzer territory.
Yep. Yeah, that's good stuff. I did hear you talking about that now. But as I say, one of my best friends has a stepdaughter who's been fighting smack for, and this has been going on for 3-4 years. And as I said, back in the 60s, I had enough brains or not enough guts, I'm not sure which. But again, falling back on what I knew best, I said, oh, if this stuff could kill Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday, it'll have an easy time with my talent, you know. Because those two were superb performers. And it's back again. I hate to sound like a paranoid maniac, but I sometimes wonder if this isn't a good upper-class way for them to keep the foot in your back.
Sure.
And
I think, depending on how the legal challenges and everything work out, we're about to find something out once and for all, and we're going to find it out in Colorado and Washington State.
Reefer?
Yeah, we're going to find out if just legalizing cannabis really does turn the entire state into a bunch of weed-crazed zombie chainsaw killers.
I think
you and I would probably agree that that's unmitigated bullshit.
Yeah.
But is it a gate? You know, will you know? For instance, with legalized cannabis, will cocaine use go up? Will heroin use go up? Will meth use go up? Will crack use go up? Will Do you see what I'm saying?
I would never touch coke. There was something about watching these people snort that stuff. And well, first of all, I'm a cheapskate. And that was an awful lot of money for what I could see getting out of that. Well, the high was lousy to me. Didn't mean a thing to me.
But you get my point, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because if none of those rates of usage go up, even though cannabis has been legalized, then we can kind of put to rest just about every argument that's ever been made about it, can't we?
Yep. It's been around. When I hear Barry Goldwater on television talking about growing up in Arizona and how reefer was all over the place, growing a wild all over the place, and, you know, it didn't seem to destroy the state in the old days. It's the old story. You know, it's, if there's a buck to be made, somebody will be there to make it. And I'll tell you that, whether they're killing you with too much heroin or too much silica or too much coal dust or whatever, man, I'm a gratifyingly happy guy, huh? Jesus, I ought to stay off the phone and let people talk. They have something funny to say, at least, or pleasant. Because the holiday, now I'll get on to that. This holiday was always popular to my family. And like the guy in A Christmas Story, the first year we lived on the projects, my granddad had made reservations and the place closed, and we ended up going to a Chinese restaurant located a few blocks away. And every time I see the movie, I sit there laughing. Because it does happen to people, and it was just I had nothing to do with it. I didn't make the reservations. And in fact, the place we were going to was a family-style restaurant, which is coming, made a comeback a lot, where they bring bowls of potatoes to the table. And that was like quite popular in this country at one time. There's some Amish folks out southeast of here that have those kind of places. The food's always excellent. But I've tied up the line enough. Let somebody else get on here. And Jim, I want to thank you for... I'll be happy to supply you with a few names and numbers, Jim. If you feel like making a few calls, I appreciate it. Because...
Like I said, those Parthian shots sting.
Well, I have a few things to say on the way out. Well, the woman that runs the office is... She's Pentecostal, and... I don't have to say any more, do I?
Floor rolling, snake handling, strychnine drinking, tongue speaking.
When I told you I learned about snake handling through... There were some articles in Life magazine in the 50s and 60s.
Well, speaking of the topic ever so briefly, Bill, I ran across an article, just the way you do on the Internet. I ran across an article a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that was talking about snake handling. And it mentioned that in the wild, a copperhead or a rattlesnake can live for in excess of a decade, maybe two decades,
yeah,
and get really old. You know how long they last in the care and keeping of these snake handling churches?
Hmm.
Maybe 9 months tops.
Man, what are they doing to them?
Oh, they're abusing them. I mean, I realize that most people would probably have a hard time getting their heads around the idea of animal abuse of a snake, because most people lose their freaking minds over a snake in the first place. But the fact of the matter is, these animals are starved. They're kept in miserable conditions. You know, these snake handlers and tote them around from one place to the next in igloo coolers and so forth. And you always want to take, when you're taking up the serpent, you always want to get him fresh out of the cooler when he's nice and cold and lethargic.
Yeah, real lethargic. You got a better shot of avoiding getting.
And if you got a problem deacon, pass him around for a while before the deacon gets him. Yeah.
My buddy in Arizona, he lives out on the edge of one of the national parks out there, and he's just shot two in the last couple of weeks because they start coming in to the house. Looking for a little more warmth, you know. And he uses they design a certain shell, he tells me, that you can buy out there that is designed to kill them, to help you put them away without... I don't know how the hell he does it. I always was afraid. That was the idea, this idea of being armed inside of a house, me with that damn five-shot shotgun, you know. I thought, well... Well, you know, if I have to use it, I'm also remodeling the walls, you know.
Right.
At the same time, but...
Yeah, that's why with a shotgun for home defense, you always want to make sure that you're not using something like buckshot. You want to use, you know, a 4 or a 6.
I was using deer slugs alternating with, you know, that's the way they sold you.
Well, you don't fool around.
No, those things would have really...
But the thing is, if you're at close range and you're in a home defense situation, this is kind of gross to talk about. Anyway.
Yeah.
The four shot or 6 shot will do the number, but if it passes, it seldom will pass through a wall, and if it does, what did that sheriff's deputy in Tennessee say? Give him a good peppering.
Peppering, huh?
But no, you know, hopefully nobody will die. It's the same reason that I don't hunt at all anymore. I used to, but I would never turkey hunt in spring gobbler season in this state.
Yeah.
Because just as somebody the other night was talking, was it you that mentioned people hunting deer up trees? No, I think that was Jeremy.
Yeah, it wasn't me, no.
You know, the famous perching deer of New England. Well, if people here in turkey season, since you know you do not, you know, you camo up to your eyebrows, and you do not wear any sort of giveaway color like blaze orange or anything, people shoot at rustlings in the bushes. People shoot at, you know, hen calls instead of gobbler calls. And what makes it worse is in the state of West Virginia, you are allowed to hunt turkeys with a rifle.
Oh my.
Now, at 100 yards, if you take 4 shot because some idiot fired into the brush without ascertaining target, it's going to hurt and you're going to have some problems, but you've got a pretty good shot at 100 yards of surviving that. But if you take a 223 round, cancel Christmas. So that's why I always stayed out of the woods during turkey season, because people are idiots. By the way, just going back, one recommendation, because I know you love music so well. Another thing for you to consider, I would think that you could get some audio book version of this by now, the Keith Richards autobiography.
Yeah, I'd like to get it, because I was...
The reason I thought about it, Bill, is because you mentioned, you know, you were talking heroin and everything. Keith Richards ascribes his longevity to the fact that he always did only the best smack, and only the pure, from only the best sources, and only the highest purity. And he says that in the pages of the book.
Well, that was one of the things I learned just from reading, was how many times the term was stepped on.
Sure.
How many times it was made heavier by adding this, that, or...
Baby laxative, B vitamin.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of...
I know more about this stuff than I probably care.
Well, one company wanted me to work as a store detector because there was such theft of baby formula. And that's exactly why. Because the fellas would use it to... I imagine they were cutting cocaine with it, too.
Oh, sure.
Surprise.
I've never fooled with either, done either one, but I don't know. I think you can step on either one with the same sort of substances. Bill, I hope you have a wonderful journey tomorrow and a wonderful sit-down at a truly magnificent table.
This is a good family. I don't care if we sat down and... If I say this, my buddy I think he loves a good joke. I don't care if they were serving beans and wieners. They're just good people to be around.
Absolutely, and that's what makes a lot of this so very special. Bill, have a good evening and a great day tomorrow. I know folks are looking forward to your visit.
Hang in there.
All right, thanks. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland, and a bunch of folks lined up on the phones now, going straight back to the phones, but I have to keep the thanks going because... Asa stepped up and answered Diane's challenge, who answered Danny's. So now Asa is on the clock, and anybody who, by any combination, wants to answer the challenge of $50 that got started by Dr. John, was carried through by Paul from Parts Unknown, answered so very, very kindly. It is much appreciated, and we'll make... heady strides toward taking a big bite out of the big hole we are in here, with the end of the month coming and a lot of bills to pay. We started out somewhere between $700 and $1,000 in the hole, and we have managed to take that down to around $500 in the hole, $450. So it can be done, and if it's possible, it badly needs to be done. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Grant from Portland.
Well, hey, Grant.
You know, thank you
for kicking in this evening.
Yeah, right on. Hey, and then just a word out to everybody. Shake it loose, man. The word needs some change. But anyway. No, your conversation with Bill, with Mr. Stress, kind of conjured me. I have this bookmark in front of me. I've sort of looked at this solution a couple of different times. Did you know that in Bath County, for 30 years, there has been running the largest electrical battery in the world? And it's basically, you've got water in a lake above.
Bath County, Virginia?
Bath County, Virginia. Yeah, it's like on the Virginia-West Virginia border, I think.
Oh, I know it. I've driven through it. It's, oh, my God, it's beautiful.
It's called the plant's called the Bath County Hydro Pump Storage Facility. And it's the perfect answer to renewable energy because you don't need any toxic chemicals. You just pump water uphill when the getting's good and the sunlight's out. And then you run it like a hydro plant during the night.
I think Waggy mentioned that in the chat room too, didn't he?
Did he? That's cool.
Yeah.
I must have missed it.
But it's a brilliant concept.
Oh, and it's simple. That's the thing I love about it. It's 19th century, you know, technology. And the cool thing is the very same things that are your hydro turbines are also your motors for pumping. You know, it just matters of what the balance on the grid is, or if it's a deficit, is which way it goes. And we could, you know, the thing I can never figure out is why we're not building these things all over the place just as regulators. You know what I'm saying? Where you can, I mean, my uncle was an operator, station operator, for PG&E out here in Bonneville. And sometimes, you know, they've got to go through somersaults to keep the phase right, to keep the 60 hertz, you know, and the power level's nominal as cogens come online or go offline or something like that. But something like this would be a godsend because they could smooth it out at any time they want. Whether there's too much energy on the grid, you just suck it up, some water uphill, or you need to release some, no worries, you just release a bit, and up it goes, and you get a little time window, and you're done. But I was just thinking about that. You know, and of course, there's those pesky wind and sunshine spills. You got to capture them somehow, right?
Oh, God, and they're such a mess, and they're so toxic, and communities have a hard time getting... My God, those wind spills. Ugh. Oh, wait, those are tornadoes. I'm sorry.
Right. But it just seemed like a perfect thing. And now this plant out in Bath County has been running for 30 years. So we already have all the tech we need to do wind and solar and store the energy during the good times. And, you know, parse it out during the lean times so that it's a continuous flow, you know. And frankly, we should be building these water batteries all over the place. You know, I mean, I can think of the Columbia River Gorge as, you know, really easy to just make a string of these things all up and down the gorge. Anyway.
Well, it's interesting you that it's in Bath County because I have mentioned from time to time that I like to, when I go back and forth to D.C., I like to take a shortcut, Grant, and get off of the interstate because I grow weary of playing tag with, you know, with semis and construction zones and things like that on the racetrack that is I-81.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get off of I-64 and take a back road up through Bath County and Augusta County, Virginia, and up all the way to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and even further if I wish, and get back on the highway and then get on I-66 to D.C. It takes a little longer, but it's a much more pleasant drive. And I really went off the beaten path back last June and wound up driving through the place is so well watered. It's on the eastern side of the Eastern Continental Divide.
Okay.
And there are these magnificent streams, and they all share names that... It starts out with the Calf Pasture River, which is just a little fordable in many places, gravel-bedded river upon which the first Kincaids settled when they first got here. I've got a romantic attachment to it.
Okay.
And then from the calf pasture, it joins the cow pasture. And the cow pasture joins to form the bull pasture. And these are beautiful, beautiful, fast-flowing rivers that run through these shaded ancient Appalachian dells that will absolutely move you to tears just to see them.
Wow.
And the geology next to it is just bizarre. I mean, you look at it, cool. And it has to be old.
Yeah, okay. Just screams ancient.
Yeah, all the dirt is worn off down to the bare bone rock, and yet wow. these scraggly-ass pines cling to it. And there are places where you can look at these mountains, and just like sometimes you can see the outline of the moon, even though only a part of it is lighted,
mm-hmm.
you can look at these mountains and see that once they were, no kidding, really bigger than the Himalayas.
Wow. Wow.
So it's beautiful country, Grant.
I'll tell you what, if you'd like, I can send you a link to that.
Oh, I'd love to read about it, yes.
You got to go on a tour of the place and see why I'm so enthusiastic about this kind of solution, because it's cheap, dirt cheap to build, and it doesn't involve exotic chemistry in any way. You know, heck, you could make a wetland out of the two lakes and you'd be fine.
Question coming in from Irish Dave, and I'm not sure that I get the entire gist of this, but he says, please ask Grant if BPA still uses interruptible power pricing for the big users. Declining block rates are the work of Satan, a.k.a. Don Hodel.
Gotcha. I really don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Well, then I imagine somebody out there is going to go to work and we'll have an answer in short order. That's cool how that works.
Yeah, the power of community. Okay, well, that's pretty much what I had to bring up. I just wanted everybody to know that this problem of storing energy has been solved and been in use for 30 years already.
I'll be darned.
Right near Bob. So I'll go ahead and send a link to it to you. You got to see if you can get on a tour or something of the place.
Next time I get over that way, I'll at least try to find it. What is it? Is it in Clifton Forge or?
Oh, I'm trying to find it. The article doesn't really get real specific about where it is. Just says its name, but I imagine with the name of the place and the county, you could probably find it. But it's called the the Bath County Hydro Pump Storage Facility. That's the name of the place.
Okay, well, I'll look at the link and go wandering around, and I'm sure that'll take me down another one of those internet rabbit holes I love so much.
Yeah, probably Uncle Google's the trick there.
Hey, Grant, I hope you guys have a happy day tomorrow.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Till thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Grant calling from the greater Portland area. And thanks going out to Liberal, live in South Carolina. Thank you very, very kindly. He answered Ace's 50 and carried the challenge forward with 50 of his own. Thank you. Thank you very much. And just a reminder that for everybody who does make all of this possible, remember that there are, and you know, I see the emails. There are a lot of people who can't for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, you're not just keeping the horn on the air. You're making it available for a lot of people who feel the same way about the horn that you do. So thank you very much, live in South Carolina. It is deeply appreciated. And if anybody wants to answer his and carry it forward, it is, well, necessary and deeply appreciated. Going forward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there, Bob.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Doing okay. Wanted to say a couple things here. You asked Bill about the blind organizations, and there are a good deal of them that do try to funnel you into social activities. And that's not all bad, but
No, I don't think anybody takes it, but you know, but Bill's larger question of how about survival before we talk about ice cream socials.
Right, exactly. And I was in I was lucky enough to go through Department of Vocational Rehabilitation for my mobility training. So, you know, and they've been pretty big help out here. Some of the blind organizations out here, like the American Council of the Blind, locally were good at it. And the NFB is, too, to a degree. But it's all, I think, in a matter of what state you're in. Obviously, your chances go a little bit further down if you're in a red state as opposed to a blue state. And, you know, that's kind of the story of that. Plus, you know, I know Bill's kind of handicapped with the computer, but if people could research some of the blind organizations over the internet that might be in his area that he may not know about, that I may not know about, you know, there's always some organization out there that you don't know about. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, and then you commented about the marijuana in Washington, California.
Or Colorado.
I don't know if you saw the story in Colorado, rather, Washington, Colorado. I don't know if you saw the story the day before yesterday, but they had this big raid out here. The Medifeds, of course, raided a lot of medical marijuana places and legal growing places, basically to make one arrest of a Colombian that was an illegal, and they were suspecting that the people were getting their product from Colombia. And so we may not find out, because there's still this ongoing war with the feds over marijuana. The state's saying they can regulate it, and the feds are saying, no, you can't, it's still illegal. Like where I'm at in these apartments. Marijuana is now legal in the state of Colorado, but I couldn't smoke it or eat it or anything else in these apartments.
Because of federal funding?
Right. Now, that wouldn't stop me if I really wanted it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
As there's so many ways you can get it besides smoking it that, you know, I doubt they'd ever find out unless they're going to take the time to go through my refrigerator toward that back corner of the refrigerator that's got, you know, stuff that's been there for 2 months that they really don't want to go through, you know.
Right.
Have at it, but I can't remember when I put that in there. Was it this year or last year? You know.
Right. Hey, I gotta interrupt for just a second because this is just too good. Just responding to what I said a few minutes ago, and to something that was said like an hour ago, which we also got an amen from Brother Fritz down in Arkansas. Irish Dave just said, Jesus, Bob, if it's a Bluebell ice cream social, it is survival at its finest. So, yeah, we got it. it's just amazing to me, Kevin, the things that that folks pick up on and riff on, because Fritz, not too awfully long back, tweeted, Bluebell ice cream is the S**T exclamation point, smiley face. Hashtag, that's what I like about Texas. That ain't Dairy Queen. So those who can't get it don't know how good it is.
I believe we can get it up here, but being diabetic, I don't go for the ice cream.
Oh, I know. I have to sin and then suffer in order to do any ice cream at all. And there's not that much that's that good. But I did. It goes as far north and as far east as Tennessee and Alabama, and I had some down that way. And it tastes, that vanilla tastes pretty close to coming out of the churn as anything I recently remember. And I think it had briars licked. See, ice cream licked. See what I did?
Yeah, well.
Oh, my God. It's tough. You're a tough crowd, Kevin.
Hey, I wanted to ask you one other thing. Have you accessed the Americans Against the Tea Party website today?
I get their email alerts.
Right, but you haven't gone on. could you or someone in the Horn family go to that site and actually click on one of the links to get the web, you know, like in the AATP email address or email, it'll give you a link to the story that you click on and
sure.
You go to the story. I'm not able to get through to it today.
Huh. I've got a story up from him because it's one of those kind of inspiring stories, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I wanted to put it out there for people's consideration. The story of Holly Cassiano from New Hampshire, and she's apparently the manager of a Sears franchise there.
Yep.
And they told her that she and the Sears employees there were going to have to work tomorrow, and she told them to piss off.
Yep.
The manager told them to.
Yep.
Told Sears to go stick it.
Yep.
So
there's another story too about a Pizza Hut manager being fired because she told him she wasn't going to open the store on Thanksgiving.
Right. So we can all. Well, I favor local joints anyway. There's a great little place over in Beckley that's it's called Roma Pizza, and they've got an actual pizza oven, not one of those conveyor belts, and they do a great pie. And they're not Pizza Hut, they're not Papa John's, and they're not Domino's. So wherever the money goes, it's A, probably staying in the community, and B, not going to support some gang of right wing horses' rear ends.
Nope. I can't remember. Oh,
and by the way, AATTP.org is opening just fine here.
Hmm. I wonder what the deal is. Did you go to the AATTP.org website or click on one of the story links?
No, I went straight to the website.
Yeah. I know the story links. I'm having trouble doing. Maybe I'll go to the website and try that. But anyway, I wanted to know to get some insight because with my accessible software, I didn't know whether it was my computer or their site or what. So, speaking of corporatocracies, there was a story in our local paper today about, was actually on the TV website, but a college player, basketball player, hit a jump shot from half court, won $20,000 at a pro game somewhere. The NCAA is making him forfeit the money or lose his college eligibility.
I'm so sick of the NCAA.
I know. Can you believe that? I mean, it has nothing to do with them. I would think he'd have a good case in court, but, you know, that takes time and legal and everything else. By the time
it's about time that some of these pro bono or public or you know for the public good law firms step up. You know, it was Curt Flood who broke the reserve clause in baseball way back when, and he caught unmitigated hell for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the reserve clause was a form of indentured servitude.
Yep.
And it badly needed to be broken.
Yep.
Well, the same. I think we're on the cusp of something similar happening with college athletics because it's intolerable now that we really have on the ground knowledge of not just how the players are treated, but how they are continually mistreated, and on top of that, the physical sacrifices that they are making of their very futures. How much longer can this be abided? It can't.
It's going to take a player like Curt Flood or a group of players. I've heard that some NCAA football players are talking about doing that because they're tired of not getting the profits that the colleges rake in over games. And these players, the only thing they're getting out of it is a scholarship. They get no spending money for anything. And, you know, yeah, they've got the scholarship. That's a lot, but you know, they're 18, 20 years old. They'd like to go out every now and then, you know. And, of course, the stars, they get that money under the table. But Joe Average football player or basketball player, you know, he's kind of out of luck. And, you know, there's got to be a better way because these guys, in essence, are pros. They're just not making money for themselves. They're making money for someone else. And I just thought it was interesting that this had nothing to do with the NCAA. He made a shot in a contest, and they want him to forfeit that $20,000 to maintain his college eligibility. And it's just, I don't understand it. You know, why? It's like to say with Kurt Flood, when that, I'm young enough to remember that, and if I remember right, he caught hell from the players, from other players.
He caught hell. He caught hell from everybody short of his mama.
Yeah. And today's players don't know what a debt of gratitude they owe him. Because without him, they wouldn't be making the salaries they are today.
No. And they wouldn't have the freedom of movement that accompanies it.
No. So, I just wanted to mention that because that's just, you know, that's kind of the embodiment of corporatocracy. The NCAA and the way they, well, you remember the Grambling story from a few weeks back, the condition of the locker room and the weight room and...
Yeah, I was thinking of that very story.
Yeah, and it took Doug Williams coming back, they had fired him, it took him coming back to the players and asking them to play, for them to go back to playing. Because they essentially said, no, we're not going to play, it's unsafe. So, and of course, they didn't hire Doug Williams back as a coach because they had a losing record, but he must have been doing something right because he was the one that talked the players into coming back and playing. So, you know, I guess the beat goes on even on Thanksgiving because... you know, these companies...
Well, there'll be two professional football games tomorrow, one in Dallas and one in Detroit.
But with all that, places like Walmart and Kmart, they don't want to be open on Thanksgiving. I worked years ago, 1983-84, I worked for Montgomery Ward's. And they made us work on July 4th. And we had absolutely no customers... I did a quick math count of the employees and what I estimated it cost the store in utilities and all that kind of stuff. The store lost money that day. There were no customers in there at all.
Right.
Because who goes to any store on July 4th? That's family outing day.
Sure.
You know.
But the consumerism on steroids society is trying to turn that around now. And you know, I talked, Kevin, about how my dad worked a whole lot of Thanksgivings, a whole lot of Christmases, a whole lot of 4th of Julys, a whole lot of birthdays, a whole lot of everything.
Yep.
And really, honest to God, you cannot turn off a furnace the day before and say, everybody go home for Thanksgiving. You can't. And more than that, I understand within the parameters of their actually doing good for society, the cops, fire departments. We have a member of the Horn family who will be on call tomorrow in a hospital in Texas.
Yep.
Okay. Those people are absolutely necessary, and I send out my gratitude and my appreciation and my thanks to those who have to do that.
Yep.
But you know what? I don't think the economy will collapse if there's one less day of godforsaken consumerism at Wally World. This has nothing to do, or Kmart, or Target, or Sam's Club, or.
Sure.
It has absolutely nothing to do with anything except trying to wring one more goddamned dollar out of people who are already stretched so thin you can read through them.
But realistically, if the store's not open today, you go tomorrow. You know, it's not going to change people's buying habits because if they go to the store on Thanksgiving, they're not going the day after Thanksgiving.
Well, see, I'm glad we're having this conversation, Kevin, because I get news releases. One of the few progressive outfits I get news releases from I got a new, I got a news, a press release today from, oh, what do they call themselves? Let me. Let me just look here. I can type better than this. Oh, what is it? The American, yeah, the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Okay.
And they're kind of a group that was pulled together by labor and some friends, some progressive organizations. The Alliance for American Manufacturing. They keep an eye on things like domestic manufacturing, manufacturing jobs. They do good work. But it just so happened today that I got an email press release from them that rubbed me the wrong daggum way. This Black Friday, buy American. That's the Alliance for American Manufacturing. As shopping season gears up, keep it American made. And it did. It pissed me off, Kevin. How about this Black Friday, don't buy a damned thing?
That's right, yeah.
How about this Black Friday, if you've got the day off after Thanksgiving, spend that with your family, too, because
exactly. This
stuff is precious.
Yep. I can count on one hand the number of times I went shopping on the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Oh, I'd rather take a whipping.
Right.
And of course, the roads are a mess here, so unless they've done yeoman work to get the roads clear because the snow's still falling, I got a feeling... If Black Friday is Black Friday, then what the hell is Thursday? Nightmare Thursday? I got a feeling it ain't going to be so good. Hey, Kevin, I do have to run on, though, because I want to try to get to a couple more of these blinking lights before we're done with time for the evening. But
All right.
I enjoyed the conversation, as I always do, and I know the Horde family does.
Okay, can you stick me on hold for just a couple minutes? I've got to get my computer fired back up.
Okay, sure. Just stand by.
Thank you.
Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. And let's keep things rolling. Oh, by the way, thanks to Jay Cruzen. He jumped in there and answered Lib in South Carolina. He called him and raised him. Or not raised. No, but he answered Lib and put forward another 50 into the bargain. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jay Cruzen. And we got some help from David in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you very much. David says, Happy Thanksgiving and Wolverines! Thanks, David. Thanks a bunch. So anybody who wants to answer David and Jay Cruzen as we close in on the end of the program this evening and we sprint toward the end of November, it is much appreciated and thank you. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Somehow my speakerphone didn't pick up. But, yeah, this is Lib.
Oh, hey, Lib.
Speaking of devil, absolutely what you're saying is right. You know, the war on Christmas, the war on Easter, the war on everything... Hell, this is a war on family. And, you know, so much of this family, what Mr. Stress gives to us is so invaluable, and all the other people. You still with me?
I'm right here.
Okay. I have a war story for you. Back when I was in elementary school, we used to pack up the old Chevy Impala station wagon back in the late 60s. Me, my brother, my sister, my aunt, who is 10 days younger than me, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, and great-grandma would drive from Kansas City, Kansas, to Chicago. to go see my dad's older sister, who was married to a fire chief. 6 inches of snow, slippery roads, you know, the whole, you know, drama trip and everything. Get there, and my Aunt Jerry, who is was a marvelous woman, cut up a card from hell. She got all the humor from that family. She was just the biggest joker, the biggest of everything. She learned, or she had heard about this new technique of cooking a Thanksgiving turkey. Put it in a paper bag and put it in the oven. Have you ever heard of that?
No. I'm a little afraid by now.
Well, she tried it. And of her many talents, cooking was not necessarily her best. Okay? So, anyways, she didn't put a drip pan underneath the turkey.
Oh, no.
And 6 inches of snow outside in Chicago on Thanksgiving, the house filled with snow, or with smoke. We are still laughing about that.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, see, that kind of opens the door with time running out. I can't give it the time it deserves, but the official Kincaid Family Horn Thanksgiving horror story has to do with me many years ago now looking at Agnes and saying, come on, pile the kids in the car. We're going to go and do the Thanksgiving shopping the night before. It's always fun that way. So off to Kroger we went.
Oh, boy.
And I'm thinking Laura was 9, which would mean that, no, Laura was 12, which would mean that Margie was 6, Ferg was 4, and Doodle was 3. And that was still within that time frame where people mistook Doodle and Ferg for twins.
Yeah.
And for reasons known but to God, or whatever, I decided it would be fun, you know, that we would leave the stroller in the car, and Laura could walk on her own, and Agnes would hold Mommy's one hand, and I would take Ferg and Doodle and, you know, push the buggy, and we began making our rounds, you know, down one aisle and back up the other, onions and celery and cornmeal and cranberry sauce and cornflake crumbs. My God. And so we got about 3 aisles in, Lib.
Yeah.
And Ferg and Doodle began to go wild. Those vast open aisles that just begged to be run through. And so they began sprinting up and down the aisle, and we had this mantra we repeated time after time after time after time. Stay with the group. Always stay with the group. Stay with the group. Well, no.
Right.
And at that point in time, we referred to Ferg and Doodle, based on the characters in the Disney Hercules movie, as Pain and Panic. The two little imps that served. Yeah.
Right.
And Agnes gave him 2 or 3 shots, allegorically warning shots across the bow. You children, stay with me. I'm serious. We'll go to the van.
Right. Don't push me.
Right. And Agnes, meanwhile, is wearing her black leather trench coat that I had gotten her the previous Christmas because it was cold outside. And so finally she gets disgusted, looks at me, and says, Laura and Margie are behaving nicely. They can stay and help you shop for Thanksgiving, Daddy, but I'm taking the bad children to the van with me. And Agnes is nothing if not a redheaded Hellcat. And
I didn't know she was a redhead.
Yeah, so she takes one child by one hand, the other child by the other hand, begins to march them unceremoniously out of the Krogers, At which point, long about that space between customer service and the first cash register, Ferg hollers, "Let me go, you mean lady."
Oh,
and
no.
And Doodle chimes in with, "You're not our real mommy."
Oh no.
Oh yes. And,
oh God.
At which point, Agnes is considering retroactive adoption or something. And Doodle,
right.
And all the little emergency, you know, the little button under the counter and the customer service.
Right.
And so she goes out and sits in the car with the two little heathens. And the,
waiting for the cops to arrive.
Which they did. And it was just like Sanford and Son.
God.
There was an older wise one and a young stupid one who proceeded to demand of her proper identification, at which Agnes looked at him and said, "Screw the identification," sticks her wrists out the window and says, "Cuff me, baby. Take me now. I'll get three hots and a cot tomorrow."
You go take care of these two heathen.
So while there are all those warm and charming Walton's Home for Christmas kind of thing, not us. But yeah, that's the short version. Lib, thank you so much for your help tonight, and thanks to everybody else who helped as well. It's so very much appreciated.
Our pleasure.
You guys have a happy Thanksgiving. I got to get out of here now. We're fresh out of time.
Everybody, happy Thanksgiving, and enjoy your family.
Thank you. Take care, Lib. Bye now. Lib in South Carolina. And thanks, everybody, for helping us see a little bit more of the daylight out, from the bottom of the hole we're in. Still in a hole, but my goodness gracious, this helps so very much. Happy feast to you all, and we will talk again either tomorrow evening or certainly come Friday. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. You with your kind contributions, our all-volunteer staff, the hardest-working people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net and ACACT.org. We always remember Gina. We always remember Gina. But especially at this holiday time. Rick Smith is up next. Happy Thanksgiving.